approve the agenda?
So moved.
So second, I move the motion by Grumman, second by Mr. Ingles. So all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Agenda's approved. And then the minutes from last week, which are pretty much, it was pretty much the calendar of what we did, so we agreed to, that's what Mr. Schwartz was passing out. So I'd entertain a motion to approve these minutes. You should have all seen them in the email. So moved by Mr. Roslin.
Second.
Second by Mr. Ingles. Okay, all in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Okay, that's approved. That, hand it over to Mr. Schwartz. Most of what we have tonight is discussion.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. It's good to see you all again. Tonight's what we consider our kickoff workshop. When I came at the end of March and we all sat and talked, it was really talk big picture about the schedule and where we are with the schedule, to make sure we kind of coordinated some of those dates and to see what worked, and to talk about really the big picture of the schedule, and a little bit we got into topics of what those various meetings would encompass and things like that. Tonight is really where we start to kick things off. And what you're going to see a good amount of tonight is things that you've already done over the last 20 years that the county's been kind of looking at this whole issue and this whole topic. We're going to be looking at some of that information again. We're not going to be looking at it from the sense that we're going to be saying, well, let's start over again. We're going to be looking at it from the sense of saying, do we all agree to it? Does it make sense? Are there any questions? That's what I'm looking to do. And the first part of this process that I talked about last time, that this will build on, is the whys. When we do the first public presentation, it's going to build on the whys. Why do you need a jail? Why do you need a courts? What are those issues? And we need to build on the understanding of that. The inmate population has grown in Cottington County. You don't have the capacity to handle those inmates, and the type of inmates you're dealing with are more severe than you were dealing with at one point in time as well. Also, the American Correctional standards that you've all heard about in some of the previous reports of what creates an unsafe jail. So helping the public to understand why is the jail not working well. From a court standpoint, why do we need more court space? What's going on? Well, that same demographic, that same thing that's happening within the community that's requiring more jail space is also requiring more courts time and more courts staff and more, the weighted caseload of what's happening within the court system and the need for additional court space, aside from the additional security concerns and some other things. So that first public presentation that we're going to start to build on is the whys. So, and this is very open and conversational, so please, anybody's got comments and thoughts as we go through this, share. First thing we wanted to go over was what the scope of our services were, or what they are, I should say. What are you expecting from the pre-designed services? Well, the pre-designed services will program confirmation, space analysis, and planning diagrams, include a variety of concept diagrams and to look at current and future needs for the courthouse and the jail as well. We'll be developing master plans. The master plan is really that as well. It's a site conceptual and how it comes together. We've talked about 5 sites. Tonight you're going to see 12 sites?
And then 12, yeah.
That we're going to talk about as far as potential options. Operational analysis. So whatever options come up, there's going to be operational impacts. If you've got a jail that's suddenly no longer a floor or single floor, but it's now 3 stories, well, what's the staffing impact to deal with inmates on a multi-level facility? The analysis, and I think we talked about it at one point in time, just the size of the building will dictate a kind of a utility and a general yearly maintenance cost and energy cost, but staffing cost is big. If you split a facility, like I think some of you saw at Douglas County in Minnesota, where you have a jail on one side of town and the courts at the other side, what's that operational impact for those officers to run back and forth, that transportation? So whatever the options are, we have to look at that. I think the construction cost, of course, will be part of that too. Whatever options we come up with, if it's remodeling an existing building, it's building a new building, what are those costs? Your requirements for the project, you talk about best value options. We will go through a pros and cons of the various site. And really, that's what we see, the part of the best value. But there's other things associated with best value, too. The property of it, the cost of it, the longevity of it. I think some of these are part of your criteria that you put together as well. We'll document all the results, and then we'll have a public awareness campaign. So in a nutshell, this is kind of what you've hired us to do. But again, we like to be nimble on our feet. So as things come up, as questions come up, matter of fact, I was explaining to a client yesterday, sometimes we think we're going straight, and next thing you know, we're taking a right. The client says, well, you know, but did we look at this? And the important thing is that we address all the appropriate topics. And sometimes we might step back a little bit and say, well, if we looked at it this way, it would help explain that one question that might come up. So we're here to help support you. So we look for you all to say, well, did you think about this? Or maybe we should look at this too, because we've had some concern in the community about that. So anyway, we're open to that. Schedule that you all have in front of you. You might, I think Lee sent it out earlier today.
It was earlier today.
So I don't know if everybody's had a chance to look at it, but take a look. You might have some questions, you might have some concerns. I think there were a number of community events that we were kind of working around to make sure that it all worked well. So
it's the same dates that are in the minutes, but good, you got a chance to look at it.
So it's got, right now we identify four public presentations. We identify tonight's kickoff meeting, but in addition to tonight's kickoff meeting, we identify 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, total of six of these meetings together to go over various criteria. And the total duration, really the report in essence will be done right around Thanksgiving, but we'll have time to mull things over, address additional concerns from the public, and have the final kind of public meetings as well. So it'll be a good amount of duration to really make sure we properly as a group address these issues and address it with the community as well.
What, can I ask you a question on that? We talked a little bit about the dates of a possible vote sometime next year. That's still up. We're still kind of, we haven't figured that out, what the best time for the community is. But so there may be, we might want to look at adding or spreading out some of the public meetings depending on, you know, just so it's well timed with that. So.
And we'll, however that makes sense for you. The first topic we're going to hit on tonight is really the courthouse and the preservation of the courthouse. Again, it's just establishing parameters so you all hear from us that we understand it and make sure that we're kind of on the same page. So you had an analysis done, the local historic society. The building is on the National Trust. It's an unbelievably gorgeous neoclassical building. And we've dealt with a lot of historic type buildings. You know, there's some things that are problematic with the building, as far as some maintenance upkeep type items, some accessibility issues, and some security issues. I think you've all seen that. But nonetheless, it's a very gorgeous historic element. It really had been the center of the county, but at least the center of Watertown since it was built. So it's a core, it's a heart of the city. I'm not going to go through all this information as far as restoration and remodeling and the things that have to occur to do that. What we will say, or what I would like to say, is we understand the core, and based on our historic work, what we would do is as we proceed with the project, there's some clear areas that the National Preservation Society talk about with historic features. The north section of that building and the North Lawn campus is really the historic character, a strong historic character to that building. Anything that was done, if there's a possibility of building, none of it affects any of that there. The rotunda of the building, so they talk about significantly historic features. So the rotunda of the building as well, that element and all the murals and everything that go into that rotunda, you don't touch that. Historically, that's kind of an off limits. So that's kind of where I wanted to say with this is, so anything we do, if there was an addition done, the addition would have to respect the front facade. And typically we like to stay back from the edge of the facade a little bit. And it'll have to look at, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but I worked on the Oklahoma historic courthouse some years ago. And it was under the same situation. And when we connected the addition to the old courthouse, it was done to respect the materials of the original building. So if there was limestone to limestone, it was quality building materials. It wouldn't be like stucco or things like this. It had to be quality materials. But it wasn't trying to copy the features of the original building. So that the way the historic society looks at it is it's recognizable what one period was done versus the other period. So. The other section we wanted to go through is just really documentation of what you have here.
This is, you want to take questions as we go through it, Bruce?
Yep.
People have.
You got him nervous.
Are we that tough?
You got him on. Thank him. He's on the road. Take him out right now.
I'm not used to standing up. I was much better last time sitting back.
You can move the computer over there.
Sit if you're more comfortable.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Thanks, appreciate it.
So we documented the area of the existing building. And this, again, as we get into discussions about how to use that building, it's what's the area in that building, how are we going to use it? If something gets moved out, what's going to fill the void of the space that's moved out? Is there adequate space if we're going to add a courtroom to this existing building? So it's just to identify and get familiar with it. So, you know, we identified the basement, the storage area of the basement. And we know that there's a connection actually to the jail, to a lower level, kind of a circuitous route from the jail into the courthouse. On the ground level, you know, the equalization office, veterans office, again, all these spaces within the courthouse and what's there, and again, just understanding them. On the first level, clerk of courts, treasurer's office, so on and so forth. So again, just to document those spaces. The second level is primarily the courts floor, the probation offices of UJS, judges' chambers and things like that, the direct court that are up there currently.
Is that located? I think there's a little bit of partition. I think it's correct.
Right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this
that
is not...
Side with the partition.
That's a little bit different there. But.
We can clean it up and get it.
Yeah. And the main thing with that, Lee, is when we start looking at remodeling and changing things. Because that judge's chamber, just the way it's shown on that plan, is pretty small. Based on what we typically see and what the National Center State Corner standards were for that. Third level is as far as the Legion's office and things that are up on that level. Very little space, single stair, today's codes, and you have one stair that accesses a level, it's very limiting what you can actually put up there. The jail area, as far as the lower level basement, folks have never walked through it, really more of a large meeting room that's been turned into a work release space and the other functions that are around in that area.
Question, Chris?
Yes, sir.
Which way are we looking?
Oh, I'm sorry. So up is east. So the north side, the rec yard, is actually to this side. And we'll clean these up a little bit more for the final report. The jail area and the addition that were on there, again, we're going to clean that out so it's a little more legible and probably add some unit numbers and things like that to it. But the addition that was put on, I believe it was 98, right? 98 addition. And then the original jail as well, and all the various housing units through there. This will be important too when we get into looking at options of repurposing some of this space. Sometimes repurposing of a jail can be expensive because of the hard construction, but again, you know, when we talk about asset management and proper use of county funds, one of the first things we look at is how do we best utilize some of this space.
Now to get into the meat of the jail topics, has everybody read or seen the study that Bill Garnos did talking about the ACA standards that weren't met, that talked about circulation? I got, Aaron and I got the 3-minute tour with the sheriff today, and we went up and down more stairs and around every corner, and I got to the point where I'm like, do you know where we're at? And he goes, no, I don't have no idea where I am. I said, good, we're just gonna follow the sheriff, because we were lost. Saying that though, there are a lot of things that come into play, and I think, you know, the bullet statements that are here, if you agree with them, great, but there are a lot more things that can be expanded on them if we really need to. Maintaining a safe and secure controlled area. Some of the things I observed today was a new booking person being asked personal questions while there were people standing in the corner. There was a interpreter with another inmate in a room. There was two more people that had nothing to do with the booking intake. So the preservation of privacy and respect to the person being booked in, there was none. I mean, that's one of those things that creates a big issue. No separation, no storage. Because of the age of the booking facility and the way you come through, presents a real risk to staff having to come from the garage up front to the booking area in the back through several doors. In a newer facility where things flow in, and as I explained to the sheriff at many of the new facilities that we work with, you can move into the, come from the sally port into a holding area, and the officer presents his paperwork, and then you can work in tandem with the corrections officer. That's difficult here. Your hallways are barely 5 feet wide, 4.5 feet wide. Two people my size could not stand side by side with a person coming in, and that's very important. In law enforcement, you don't want to be in front, you don't want to be in back for fear of getting kicked or assaulted or hurt. You need to maintain control. That's not available. You know, managing the physical designs the parameters. You know, when you think about it, you've got work release people that are in the basement that's in a meeting room that are coming up. To get them up there, there's not a paging system. They have to call in. They may be trustees. That's a word that I chuckle. You're in jail, you can't let you out, but you're a trustee.
Would you mind defining some of the terms? Just not everybody knows what knows what trustees are, but not everybody here knows.
Okay, in the jail system, most oftentimes, traditionally, they classified people minimum, medium, max custodies based on the level and what the charge was when they're coming in. That is now changing on a more national level, where you're going to have a minimum custody person. That's somebody that can go out to work release. Not a threat to themselves or others. The categories that are changing, instead of medium and max, you're seeing more special management people. Special management could be mental health. It could be someone who has a chemical issue, who's assaultive, who has got a cultural issue or a race issue. That's a special management person. The other category that we're seeing is general population, meaning you are a threat to the public. You meet the standard that, and the judge says, no, you're not allowed, or you're not going to be accepted to go out back into the public. So you are a general population person. If you operate in an appropriate manner, you're considered general population. If you're a fighter, if you've got gang issues, if you've got many other issues, you'd be classified as special management person and may have to be separated from everyone else. A trustee is nothing more than someone who's a general population inmate that has chosen to assist the officers, whether they're in the kitchen or doing some cleaning in the hallway. You know, they're participating. I was going to say they're normal. They are in a situation where, you know, they're willing to cooperate and do their time in a manner that's respectful to both themselves and the other officers there. Does that help kind of describe where things are at? Because oftentimes you're going to hear, well, this one's minimum, this one's medium, this one's max. That's really hard to delineate the difference between the two. They make booking programs with numbers, but I could put you all to sleep if we were going to talk about that. But in reality, when you talk about the behavior of the inmate when he comes in, is going to define basically where he's at. Interestingly enough, you know, the example is someone creates a heinous crime like a murder can be a general population person. He could be a trustee to a point, maybe cleaning or sweeping, because he's participating. Obviously, he's a threat to the public and will not be allowed out. On the flip side, you could have a young person coming in who's chemically dependent, and he's angry, and he's a fighter, and he's just defiant. He could be a special management, or she could be a special management person that is going to need to be segregated from everybody else because he's a threat to himself and to the population and staff inside the jail. So I could call the murderer a max custody person, but if they're cooperating internally in the jail, and the classification is for in the jail, he's not going to be released either way, and he's cooperating. I could call the other person a max custody because he is a threat. If you walk into the unit, he could assault you. He may be temperamental. He may be unstable. So not to belabor that, but one of the biggest things that this jail has, and it reflects it in the report, and also it was just looking at it today, is there are many, many blind corners. There is inaccessibility into the units. If you haven't taken a tour of the jail, I would surely ask the sheriff and jail administrator to take a walk through. It's not to scare people, it's to see the type of environment that's there. 90% of the people in your community don't know what happens when that car goes into the garage. They have no idea what it takes to manage somebody who's angry, who has, you know, been arrested for a DWI, and maybe somebody who's never been involved with the law but made a mistake. You know, and the thing to remember is people that are in jail, not all of them are bad people. They made some bad choices, and they have the ability to come back out. There is that percentage that needs the security of the facility. That percentage that's there needs to be safe, and moreover, the staff need to be safe. I think in our interview I did the analogy. Inmates come and go. Staff stay for 25 years. They do a life sentence. It's not a proud thing to say, but you need a safe, healthy environment for them in order to emulate that to the people coming and going through the facility.
I want to ask a quick question on what Al said. By a show of hands, who all has been through the jail? There's a couple of you I know. It's actually a good percentage to have been through it, which is good.
For those of you that haven't, I mean, if ever the next time we're back, I'd come here early and do the walkthrough with the assistance of the sheriff and the jail administrator. It's an eye-opener. It really is, and to understand what you have to do in the process of getting people in and out to meet your court schedules, to get people out of work release, get them back in, pat search and make sure there isn't contraband coming through. It's a organized mess is what it is. I mean, it works really well, but it's very organized. It's challenging.
So again, the bullet points that we're talking to and a lot of things that Al's talking about, things that were in previous reports.
Yeah.
And they help to identify some of those problems. You know, luckily you haven't had a prisoner suicide. It's a very thankful thing, but we have seen other counties where they've had that occur. And that's not only is it a sad situation for the inmate, sad situation for the family, it's a tremendous liability on the county as well. So there's things that haven't happened in Cottington County, and you hope they don't, but again, it's all these, that's part of the reason, I don't know if you're going to go there, but part of the reason for the ACA standards is right. To mitigate some of that potential liability.
Yes. Go ahead.
So are there suicide rooms equipped differently?
Yes, there are areas in placing people in what would be called direct supervision or direct line of sight. Being able to be cameraed, be able to have I don't know if you have a suicide smock or not, but the biggest thing is being able to have a set of eyes on them. For example, there's a tiny little control room in many new facilities. There may be a room directly adjacent to that, so the person that runs the controls has a sight here, plus there's a camera there, and it's in front. So not only are they doing documented 15-minute checks, they have continuous eyes on that person. As they move, it's there. You know, that's the type of thing that has to be there for that type of situation.
They used to do more padded room kind of things. Yes. You don't really see those as much. Matter of fact, I think there was an issue with those for some reason.
The bottom line is they don't do a lot of padded rooms because the county is still liable. If the guy backs up and runs his head into the wall for the fourth time and he goes down and he's bleeding, you still have to care to him. And now if he's created long-term injury, the county is going to end up paying for that. So they have to intervene when there is a point for which they are going to harm themselves. I mean, in there they have a restraint chair that can be used, but they don't have a room to put it in because it's not set up for it. The other thing is when Bruce gives an example of a suicide and you haven't had one, I've always heard, well, we haven't had one, so I don't worry about it. The reason you haven't had that is you've got some really good staff in the jail. And that goes towards the jail administrator and the sheriff. That's an awesome thing to say that we haven't had one. To say it can't happen, I would never be there. But I don't take the Chicken Little, the sky's falling. I'm going to say it hasn't happened because there is good management and the people are there. When it does happen, hopefully it never does, it is devastating. You know, I've had, in my career, I had two. It's still still haunts people, still haunts me.
And I should say, too, and probably should preface this, too, is state of South Dakota requires that a county run and operate jail facilities and courts facilities. So these aren't somewhat of a voluntary facilities. They're mandatory by state statute. So,
you know, I think the other things, you know, we can go through the bullet points. If there's anything that you see on there that raises a question or a red flag, but the one thing that really sticks out to me is the lack of proper backup to handle emergency situations. Bringing a stretcher into the jail is a challenge. Your sally ports are not 9 feet wide. They're not 5 or 9 feet long, 5 feet wide. Again, two people. You almost have to throw the stretcher in, close the door. If somebody opens, bring the stretcher out, and then have the people follow it through. Responding to issues at hand are one of the biggest things that I saw today. And again, we were up and down from the basement to the new part to the old part. And we did a quick tour because we had a lot of other things that we were going to address. But seeing what was there, you know, does tell me that without the management that's there right now, you could have chaos in the facility because the staff aren't running the facility. The facility is being operated by cooperative inmates. And that's a different way of looking at it. Because staff communicate well, the inmates are working well. But you get the right culture in there, you may not have it as easy. And it rotates through because they don't stay like you would in a prison situation. As far as proactively defending lawsuits, I mean, that's an ongoing thing. A newer facility obviously can help that. This facility is challenging for that. The other one that really stuck out is the inability to supervise prisoners properly. The need, there is no programming space that we really could see. The meeting room downstairs is a dorm. One of the things in managing people who are incarcerated, two things that the number one is obviously if you have a decent meal, they're at least going to have a full tummy and they're not going to be anxious. And number two, if you can offer them a program, whether it's a religious program, something as simple as a GED or something that they can go to and they have some ownership in, and you try to change the criminal thinking that is going on, allows for a better culture and hopefully a lower recidivism.
Yeah, so the idea of program spaces, a lot of times it's physical activities. State of Minnesota mandates 1,000 square feet for physical space. A lot of counties will provide additional programming space, like Al said, libraries, spaces where you can have church services. There was one recently that had a musical deal in there to allow inmates to do things. And it's an opportunity, too, for kind of management control. It's you're allowing those inmates to use those types of spaces when they're doing what they need to do and not causing problems. You're restraining or retaining those opportunities when they're not doing what they should be doing. So it's a great reward kind of motivator as well.
You know, there isn't a picture of a graduation of a GED person on the wall because I don't know if you had any. That's a big thing when the sheriff can hand a GED over to an inmate that was in there that could test out or that, you know, that's a positive. You're sending him out better than what he came in. Not to belabor that, going to the next slide, Bruce, you know, reviewing of the jail studies, there were several studies that were done. One of the glaring things that came up on your latest study by Bill Garnos, the jail consultant, when he did population projections, here's one of the challenges that we're going to run into. And we don't have it up here. I've got it in the study, and maybe Lee, we can hand it out. But he did an average daily population, and he did a population projection. He started out that in year 2016, the jail's going to need 81 beds. Today, you had a capacity of
86.
So we are already over where he started. That unto itself presents a problem. Not a big problem, but in the final jail number, he put a number in there between 120 and 140, which is a somewhat dangerous thing to do without having a design. The reason I say that is you see what they're operating with now, and if you could see down the road a design that's there, jail breaks up into three different areas. You have booking, intake, and release. That's where people come and go, in and out. You have your general population. That's your people that stay there. They aren't going anywhere. Then you have your work release group that go in and out of the jail on a daily basis. Determining the numbers that are there has to take into consideration you need some functional flexibility. We can talk about 120 beds at 100% double bunk is 60 cells. If we group three cells together or two cells together over under and call it a unit, we would have we'd have eight people in that unit. Everybody following me? If all of a sudden we only have one female and we put her in that unit, we now have taken away seven beds. We have neutralized that. So as we go down the track, the number that we're talking about is a number that, people have to accept and understand, because the next phase will be to define the number and then define the classification. If you're general population and you're cooperative and you're male, we can put you here. If you're general population and you're female, we can put you here. If you're pretrial, we may have to keep you separate. If there's somebody who is special management, and you can define that in many different ways, mental health, race, ethnicity, gang affiliation, there are a lot of times that people have to be separated. Understanding that each time we do that, or one of the tougher ones, a lot of your arrests come from the Watertown area. The majority of your people live in this area and are picked up off the highway. They know each other. I mean, the worst is I get arrested and they say, well, keep away from Lee. You can't be next to him because they're going to talk, or, you know, we're brother-in-laws and we don't get along, or, you know, that gal up there used to babysit your kids. And it's like, okay, that's even more challenging because you have to preserve the evidence and make sure that you don't, you know, they get intimidated and lose the case. So talking about classification will be the next thing that's there, or separation. But the bigger thing that is going to be challenging is coming up with a number. That number defines and triggers the square footage for everything else. The appropriate hallway space, the appropriate day room space. And in the report, the ACA standards talk about encumbered space versus unencumbered space. Meaning, in Minnesota, a cell can be 70 square feet. It can have the bunk, two bunks in there and a toilet. Doesn't matter. If it's ACA standards, it would be 70 square feet unencumbered, which means it would be more like 82 square feet per cell, because you can't count the space underneath the bed or underneath the little table that's there or underneath the toilet. That's the difference in standards that are there. So as we go through, understand that the number that we're docking at affects what the architects do when they're doing their spatial analysis. That I didn't see in anything that was done in previous reports and the previous architect that was there. There was not a clear delineation of how they came to the numbers that were there, other than saying you need 120 square feet. Well, you can throw a rough number at that, but that's not, 120 units, it's challenging. So,
so one of the things we're going to talk about tonight, which will be a big discussion topic, is what's the right number? I mean, we have a sense for what we think is appropriate based on what we've seen in your trends and your average daily population in the county. We also want to talk about future expansion. But in that time between now and the next meeting, we're going to have conversations with Tom, we're going to have conversations with the sheriff, and we're going to look at the data that's been developed and what you've been seeing so far in 2016 and start to identify those classifications. Typically, like Al was saying, you like to have, you know, you've all toured, or a number of you have toured some of these jail facilities, and you see this kind of podular design. First off, I'll explain that a lot of the old linear jails, like kind of what you have, the linear versus podular. Linear is much more staff intensive. You really don't have that direct sight of vision, and it creates staffing complexity and response complexity. The newer designs are all podular design, where you can really see, you're not relying on cameras, you're right there. The other thing we like to do when we start doing planning is to provide either sub-day rooms where you can separate inmates within a certain unit, or smaller day rooms, anywhere from 8 to 16. The problem some jails have had, if they've designed their jail facilities, they've needed 100 beds or whatever, and they said, okay, here's a 50-bed unit, here's a 50-bed unit. Gives you no classification, no separation. By doing it smaller, allows you to control the population and create a separation. Anyway, the main thing I want to say is by the next time we meet, we will have a kind of breakdown of those various classifications.
Your Honor, I'll put you on the spot. As far as pretrial versus sentenced, do you have an issue if a pretrial person and a sentenced person is in the same unit together? What is the South Dakota law saying on that?
I don't think there is one.
Okay.
Yeah, I've just left it up to the jail since I've been on the bench.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, from the judge's perspective, I don't care if they're sentenced or unsentenced. I've even gotten letters from inmates where they say, well, they've got me on the unsentenced side and I should be sentenced. I'm like, I don't care where you are, as long as you're in jail.
I get letters like that all the time, too. And
yeah.
I just say that as a security issue with the sheriff, and we'll go by his rules.
And that helps, because in Minnesota, for example, there's 8 classifications because of the pretrial and sentenced and male and female and special management. So you could be pretrial special management or you could be sentenced special management. And now the inspectors are telling them you have to separate them. And the jail administrators and sheriffs are pulling their hairs off going, what do you want me to do? Rebuild the jail? It's not going to happen. We're in violation. You know, citing. Yes, sir.
I'm not sure you folks are the right ones to answer this, but what effect do inmates from out of county have on our numbers, and is that positive projection for that in the future?
I'm going to let these gentlemen go. To answer your question quickly, it's less than 10%, and the sheriff can give those numbers up for them. But that's on the website, and there's a lot of good data on there. I can get with you and point you to that if you'd like later. But that's a good question. That's a common question. But I want to let these guys stay on track.
Yeah, in most cases, in your case, 90% of your people that are long-term people in the jail are local. When I say local, they're Coddington County people versus transient mobile people, which I was quite surprised because you've got Interstate 29 here. It has been deemed a drug corridor from Texas all the way to Canada. I know Fargo gets hit, and I know Grand Forks gets hit. I mean, it's Sioux Falls. They cut up to Wilmer and come up to St. Cloud where I live. So, I mean, when you work with law enforcement, you know the routes that they're at, and that's one that gets watched a lot. But it is amazing that it's only 10% of all the people.
Yeah, it's less than that. There are other counties' inmates.
That's right.
Yeah, so these are mostly over 90% of the arrest taking place in Cottingham County.
And the primary care is you're holding for Clark County, is it Duell County?
Duell.
Excuse me. In Hamlin County, primary counties you're at. And the inmates are maybe one or two a day in some of these counties, so it's a very small percentage.
So knowing that the judge, the courts are comfortable with a pretrial and a sentenced person being together, helps work that number, because that would have raised that number if they'd have said, no, I need to see that separate. We now went to 8 classifications. If it's 100 beds and we've got to do 8 classifications, now we've got to ferret out how many are in pretrial, how many are sentenced. In this case, we're back to 3 major classifications, minimum, general population, and special management. Now we're able to address accordingly. As Bruce was talking about, when they talk of a sub-day room, in a jail pod where you have 6 cell or 4 cells over 4 cells, a 16-bed unit, the mezzanine, which is the upper stairs, is extended out 8 to 10 feet, and it's glassed in. We call that a sub-day room. That is our special management area for somebody who's not cooperating. And the reason we talk about that is in the prison systems, they always talk about going to the hole or going to segregation. Well, in a county jail, they don't have that. That's not an option. It doesn't exist. You have to work with them from a behavioral management standpoint. So if someone is not cooperating, you move them all the way back to the back cell, allow them out into the first sub-day room, which meets all the ACA standards for recreation. And then from there, if they're cooperating, you can move them out into the general day room with the rest of the population. If they don't cooperate, you move them backwards again. It's disciplinary. It's not non-disciplinary. It's using more behavior management, which is a big thing that will bode well for operations. You can write them up, you can take away their birthday, but if they're going to be there for a while, they're only going to get more angry. They have to understand their behaviors and be able to change their behaviors.
When you're planning for the different population groups, do you also then have to plan for general population male, general population female?
Correct.
So, okay, so yes. There's really six if you...
There's really six, yes, when you put the genders into it, yes.
Okay, thanks.
And again, for that small podular design, that actually works well. I mean, even though we have seen, and I'm sure your data reflects it, but we've seen across the country female population has been increasing. Not only have they been increasing, they tend to be more problematic inmates than we're seeing, we used to see as well.
Is just a question. So it sounds like maybe at some point, maybe I guess tonight, it's probably not a good time to do it. We need to be talking about classifications. I mean, there might be some, and that, because that's an operational issue in the jail. And I'm not the person that I've ever seen have that discussion. Is that a topic that we need?
Everything's up for discussion the way we see it. Again, this transparent process of making sure we inform and discuss each. We're going to be relying on data that we see in the report, our understanding and our use of creating the segregation and separation, but we're going to use a lot of information when we start to look at that. And it's going to be conversations with Tom and the sheriff of what they see for the types of individuals they're dealing with. So what we'll do prior to next meeting is once we talk about a number, we're going to talk about how you get there and what makes sense.
But here's one of the best examples. In a new facility in the booking area, there's, based on the size, and let's just say the number is 100 beds. In the booking area itself, we look at the number of bookings that they have per day, number of people coming in and out. Look at the weekends, look at the highest point. Say you say there are 10 people that come in over the weekend. That would be the minimum number of cells that we would have in the booking area. The reason for that is you get arrested on a Friday night at a 0.10. If the judge has given a standing order to the courts or to the jail that you can release on their own recognizance, give them a court date once they're below the legal limit and they're released to a responsible party, that person never goes back into the general population. They stay in the booking area. That scenario can happen with a juvenile transport, that can happen with a male, it can happen with a female. Right now, when they are arrested, they are put into the general population. So, again, if are those 10 beds, are we counting them as our capacity, or is that our management tool, because it's also going to be for court staging. You bring them from the general unit, put there, and then they would go to court with a bailiff or another officer. What are those beds? If it's 100, do we add 10 more? Now the number is 110. See where I'm going? So when we're talking the number, how do we get to that number, and what is the understanding that you as the focus group is here? Because the last thing I want to do is have somebody go out and say, well, it's 100 bed capacity. The guy goes, yeah, there's 110 here. You're lying to us. No. Here's our operational process. These people, the sheriff and the administration has committed that they will not be there. If they're going to be a holdover, they will be booked in and put into general population. If you know that they're going to be booked in Friday night, but Monday morning when they see the judge, they'll be gone, they're not going to contaminate the population. They're going to stay in the booking area so as to manage them from there.
So those are regular size cells?
Regular size cells, okay. Yes. They would have a toilet in them. They would have everything. They would probably be cameraed also. So you're recording things. A lot of times with the DUIs, you know, there's no reason to put them back with the other people. Once they wake up, sober up, many of them are remorseful. Depending upon the level of, you know, what they came in at, they may be able to be released. And if they can be released, you get them back out of there. You don't need to deteriorate them more if that's, you know, if that's appropriate. You know, some counties don't do that. Some counties will say, no, you're arrested until you see the judge, you're in. But still, at that, if you know it's Monday morning and it happens on Saturday night, there's no reason to take them and put them in a population to be verbally abused and embarrassed. You work with them right there, you stabilize them so when they go to court, they've got some wits underneath them, they've got some legs underneath them. Does that make sense? So, again, yes, sir.
I was wondering, you're talking about the eight man pods and the larger pods. You can have a mix, can't you? I mean, you have like couple larger ones and then some of the smaller pods.
Exactly.
Yes.
And a lot of times, exactly, a lot of times what you'll see is the general population, like Alan's talking about, could be a 24 or 32 bed unit. Because again, there's the minimum security, minimum risk, and it's not an issue. The other thing, too, that we'll talk about a little bit as we get into that mix is dorms versus hard sells.
Yes.
If you have a work release scenario where inmates are allowed to go out during the day or whatever because they have a job prior to being arrested, and actually there's some facilities allow them to have a job afterwards, if you have a sentence to serve crew and things like that, but a lot of times those individuals, because of the level of their offense and severity, can be more in a dormitory type setting, and sometimes it's fine. It's a less expensive construction, but again, it's a lower risk that you're looking at. But the ability to have cells to separate actually gives you a lot more control over the long run of the type of individuals are in the cell, or in the jail. So I think, again, making sure, like Al said, if you have too many that are long enough, Hubbard County, Minnesota, it's large dorms, large cell areas that weren't segregated into smaller pods, and they couldn't use them. They had a few inmates, and they would have to staff them. That's the other thing, too, is we've actually designed a new facility where, well, again, Minnesota and some other states are a little different because they have staffing regulations. The staffing relates to the number of inmates you have and the type of design you have. But you can design a facility that, as you grow, as you have more inmates, sometimes you're adding staff to accommodate that. So the operational efficiency can be reflected in the design and layout as well, clearly.
You'll see that if we are putting a dorm in an area, we're going to go back and talk about the operation. If all of a sudden one person has to manage 24 people in a room and they have to go in there and there are issues, you've got 24 guys that can have an issue versus being able to have 12 cells and put them in. Where's the value? And I can show you many facilities that did build-outs and didn't fill them, and then years later, a couple of years later, what would have been $600,000 to finish is almost $2 million to finish that same area. And that's Kanawha County and more of Minnesota. They didn't finish. So, I mean, there's examples of things that are there, concrete examples that we can show people. Again, it works with talking to the public and saying, this is where our final number came to, both from an inmate capacity, an operational capacity, and then if we said the number was 90 beds, well, we've got 2 beds left. We've just lost our classification because now we're going to trade a body for a bed. So we're going to need usually a 10%. The industry standards is 10% beds kind of left open to be able to move people around. I mean, in new jails, they have what they call the cell house shuffle. You get a different culture. You have 5 women that come in over the weekend. Well, you 8 guys, guess what? Pack up your stuff. Get it out. Women pack up your stuff. You're taking over that unit. The guys go over here. That's a very common thing. That's good management of what you've got.
But it also is an operational nightmare, too, to have to do those kinds of things.
Yeah, it is, but it, you know.
It does. So the next, some of the other things I want to go through, too, to make sure we hit on is when, and again, when we go to the public and we're presenting some of these things, it's going to be, this is the existing conditions, and these are how things compare to the ECE standards. And so these listed, it's a lot of verbiage. Tell you the truth, when we like to do presentations, we like to kind of boil it down to some pictures and bullet points, so it's more absorbable than kind of having to read a lot of information. We want to talk about the cells.
Yeah.
Some
of the things, when you talk about the cells, you read the ECE standard, it says a standard of 35 unencumbered square feet per inmate. Okay? Again, 35 unencumbered square feet is not a 5x7. It's 10x7, and then you take out the space underneath the bunk here, or where the sink and accommodation stool is. That 18-inch block is taken out of the square footage of that 70 square feet. So that means the room grows. Does everybody understand that when you talk about unencumbered square feet? That's a real different one because of ACA standards that requires that. You go to Nebraska, Iowa, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin does not have, because they have jail standards, they don't require unencumbered square feet, they have gross square footage. There's a difference. So Everybody says, yeah, it's great. We don't have rules. Well, it's not always to your advantage if you're licensed, you know, if you're going into the ACA standards the way you're supposed to. There are some books and there are some changes in things.
And I'm assuming for this facility that if we're going to follow a standard for a project, we're going to follow the same. So my assumption is we're not going to deviate the cell size. We would go with the ACA requirements.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of feel that that makes sense.
When you look at toilets, you're looking at one toilet for 8 people. If you look at the amount of toilets and showers that you have in the jail right now, you would probably, I think the study said you could have a maximum of 48 people in the jail if you were to meet current ACA standards right now with what's there in the facilities.
Low 60s.
Is that where
the whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing, yeah. So that's the type of thing, again, when you start looking at what's there, the shower ratios, the day space, program space. What's interesting is holding areas have to be a minimum of 200 square feet in the intake area plus 10 square feet per inmate afterwards. So in other words, if you've got court holding, I got a 10 by 20 room and there's 15 people going to court, you know that you've got to have at least, well, if you put it all the way in, it'd be 350 square feet, which is huge. So you take it to your minimum and know that you're going to house it. Again, it's not as big of an issue, but those are some of the types of things that have to be worked through as you figure out the square footage of what goes into a jail. And, I will sit with everybody as you walk through it, because as we go through this process, one thing you'll hear from me, everything starts at the sally port. That's the garage. That's where the officer drives in, he parks his car, and the doors come closed. How do we manage that person from there? How do we get him in to booking? How do we process that person? How do we shower him and change him out? Are they staying local, meaning in the booking area, or are they going into general population? But one of the things that I want everybody to understand that intake area is considered the hub of the jail. When they go to court, they come out of their cell unit. If they're going to be cuffed and shackled, they get cuffed and shackled. Their storage of stuff has to be there. They go to courts and they're escorted. If they're released, they get their property there. They get their check. They go from there. So you'll hear me talk a lot of where they're coming in and how are they going through.
Day room's another space. So when you think of a facility, the cells are where they're sleeping. Basically living in the evening, the day room is really their living room. It's where they're sitting, they're reading, they're playing cards, they're watching TV. So the day room size. So again, the American Correctional Association has a certain requirement of square footage, and that's really to allow for that least conflict of people being too crammed in a space and creating potential tensions and issues that could come from that. So I think it's worth 35
square feet also.
So. Again, good standards for identifying that. And right now, your facility is way below that as well.
Question?
Yeah. Just to clarify on what Bill Garnes' report said, I think it was 62 beds, not necessarily inmates, as far as if you were to just take the one square footage and divvy that by.
You could get 62 beds.
I think 62
all
beds.
All right.
So that's going to be less than that.
Yeah.
Is that summary?
Correct.
Here goes to your question, talking about the number of arrests. If you look, for example, the arrests in 2015, just with the South Dakota Highway Patrol on the bottom, which is the blue, right down here, South Dakota Highway Patrol arrests in 2013 were 272, 2014, 429. 2015, 947. If you look at the different counties, Cottington County, 1533, they actually went down in 2014 and then up again to, is that 16 or 18? 1814 in 2015. What this translates to is how many of those people that are staying and how long are they staying. It's called an average length of stay. We're not so much concerned with the people that are staying there as we are the people coming in. Talking about the intake booking area, which you don't have right now, if we can service a third of those people that stay there less than 3 days, knowing that they're not going into general population, that augments the overall population and general population because they're in and out. Does that make sense? You're booked in on Friday, you go to court on Monday, you're out of there. I'm holding you in booking, I'm not taking you back here. I'm not counting you as my overall population, I'm counting you as my temporary population, I have you on the board. It sounds a little confusing, but when you look at that, this number, as you break it down, it says average days, daily sentence.
Yeah, we're, that's, by the way, that's that chart there, that's from UJS statistics, and we're not totally sure how they come up with that. We're working on, that's a draft.
Okay.
Graph right there, but essentially that's that might just be the portion of sentence that hasn't been served yet in pretrial.
Okay.
We're working on that one. So
my goal at the end of this whole thing, there will be a test, and you all will be junior jail consultants, and I can retire. So be ready.
Thought you've already done it.
I did retire once and twice. I just love this too much. But the whole thing is understanding, again, the average length of stay. How long are they here? Why are they here? You know, the more we can move through with the appropriate segregation, separation. If I have 10 people in my booking area, I don't have to have day room space. I do not have to have a lot of different things because they are called a temporary hold. And we can hold them for up to 72 hours. We could have a shower in the cell so they could shower in there and I could transfer clothes through the food port instead of taking them out and moving them, which makes it safer for staff and you reduce the exposure of male-female or female-to-male. Little things that nobody thinks about, but when you're booking a female inmate and all of a sudden they want to create trouble, it doesn't take much to send a letter up to the attorney or to the judge that said, you know, Bruce was looking at me when I was showering. May not even know what was happening, and Bruce wasn't in the area, but you have to address that as a potential, you know, sexual assault, and that whole process of just having to go through that. So again, things we have to look at. If this is still being looked at, then we're not going to go real deep in this, because this is what really caught my eye, were the number of bookings. Then you break that out from this. In the study, it talks about here's your gross number of bookings, here's your bookings by days. What it did break out is what's by times. For example, you have a large casino here. Help me out here. Okay. Traditionally, in several counties in Minnesota, the highest booking is out-of-county people in counties that have casinos on Sunday nights. Now, nobody would have thought that at all. You'd have thought a Friday or Saturday we're partying, we're having fun. Sunday's the reality, they're out of money, they have to go back. They've been drinking a little too much. They go from the Twin Cities, or from northern Minnesota back to Twin Cities out of the casino, or south of the metro casino back to their house. There are more higher arrests during that time because of that type of stress, the alcohol and the combination of, you know, I just lost my butt, I just lost my paycheck. You hear that a lot. When I walk through jails and I look at records, the first thing that pops out to me when I see a high arrest rates on Sundays is, you know, is there alternate gaming someplace? Just a little tidbit. You learn some things that are funky. Let's go to the next one, Bruce.
I think we need to talk about where we see the inmate population being. I mean, you know, you can see that on the top chart, the top graph up here, there's a clear linear increase of what's occurring in, as far as projection that Bill was looking at. You, if you continue to project that out, you know, it's going to just continue to grow and grow and grow. I think, Judge, how long ago was it when you made 1 minute drug court? Is it fairly new?
About a year.
And that should have some effects of helping to reduce potential jail time and anything, because that's part of the drug court philosophy, is to reduce some of that. Are there other programs the county's looking at that I'm not aware of? I forgot if we talked about electronic home monitoring or any of those types.
I think the sheriff can talk to it. We haven't talked about it, but I think the big thing that's going on now we're getting the drug court, the red court, going. There are a few diversion programs like Teen Court. And then the other thing we're working on is addressing mental illness. inmates in the jail. And you know, that's probably not going to be a huge reduction, but at least we need to get a better picture of what's going on there. And then at some point, yeah, it's going to have a positive effect on
And that's a really good point, because diversion programs don't suddenly cut your population in half. They don't typically even reduce it by 20%. It's a small reduction, but what you see is by doing some of those programs, which do cost to run those programs, whether it's drug court, whether it's teen programs, whatever, or even electronic monitor, they cost money to run those programs. The goal is that they're hoping to reduce some jail days that an inmate would serve, the number of days they'd serve, to reduce their time.
But in your experience, would it be fair to say that those kinds of programs, maybe when we're in a situation like this, Minnehaha is in a similar situation where they're, you know, they're trying to look at those incarceration alternatives. And is that, that's when you're in a situation where you have to build a jail, I'm not so sure that we're going to be able to shave off more than one or two beds. But it might be that building lasts a lot longer. So
that's a really actually a good point, is what you're trying to do is allow. And then, because what I was going to say is, if you took this linear projection and we're building a 50-year facility, and we've carried it out right now to Bill carried this out to 2035.
20 years. Yes, it'll be 20 years.
Yeah, 20 years. So if you learn to continue, the question is, are we adding another 20, 30, 40 beds in that period of time? What we see where you're at population-wise right now, and just our general conversation.
This is 2015 right here, and it says in 5 years you should be at 86 beds. And we're there already before you've built something. If you've built something and it passes, it takes two years. So, I mean...
I'll just say something in fairness to that study, though. You know, we were looking at the gross numbers for South Dakota Highway Patrol. But that, and I think, as I understand the situation, Sheriff can chime in if I'm wrong, is that that squad, that the local detachment here, is fully staffed, and you know they're doing the job, and so that's just the result of that.
This chart, though, that Bill Genya's put together, that wasn't based on this highway patrol.
But I'm just saying that's the new factor that kind of
and apparently. Let's put it out there. Bill's not inaccurate in what he's doing. No. He did what he did at the time. He put it together. I mean, that's one of the things that trends change. Things change, okay? So when somebody says, give me a number, and I'm going to go back to that. How are we collectively as a group going to agree on a number? It's very, very challenging to do that. Bill did a phenomenal job on the study. He did a really nice job of delineating everything that worked in the jail. And his projections that he has up there is a formulated projection that's there. How, when in 5 years you need 86 and we're already there, how do you feel as a group we should proceed to develop the number, or do you want us to come back with?
I'm going to give you our professional opinion. I'm just going to cut to the chase. If you had 86 inmates, and we talked about the 10% operational factor, that's roughly another 9 beds that's needed for the jail. So that's roughly 95, pretty close to that. We think the facility at 120 beds is a probably appropriate number. We also want to talk about, that's what we feel.
That's right now, you're saying?
No, building a 120-bed facility to last you to 2035 is what we feel should be appropriate. We're having a hard time justifying that your incarceration, and it has to do with recidivism and things like that for the number of days, not a lot of time people need to spend in jail. We're having a hard time justifying that it's going to continue to climb at a steep spike like it has been. We think the 120 is appropriate, but we also think that there needs to be some future growth factor built into this. And that's, again, to be a good steward of the county's money and where this budget of this project goes, it would be very simple to build a 140-bed facility now. And that's build one of the pros and cons we talked about. But to save money and do it more prudently over time, if you build a 120-bed facility with the ability to add 124 30 beds in the future will actually be a more appropriate way to deal with the future growth.
Mark. I
issue you guys have filed with the sheriff's on that as we go through that.
And we'll be talking about it more, but that was our...
This was a whole 65-mile discussion all the way out here today. We went back and forth at each other because it is very important. The last thing you want to do is say, yeah, you need a 150-bed jail. No, you don't. Well, how? But what is? What is our number? Giving the 120 example, does that include the 10 that we put into booking, or is that without the 10? You know what I mean? Not a right or wrong. It's a comfort level with what's here because that affects the architect's number when you look at the gross picture. So it takes a lot of, we're going to dig into it a lot more, but it takes a lot of understanding that when we're coming up with a number that's there, it's something that's going to get you, it better get you 35 years.
Bob, you were concerned about something up there. I'll give you a chance
to express your concern. I'll provide you with some numbers down the line. I don't want to disrupt your process. I'll do a different analysis of some of the numbers. So.
Okay. Questions? I mean,
no.
Answers? Okay. All right. Clear as mud so far?
Yes, sir.
What do you attribute? I think you said 20 were the right there. Now the loan right.
Right there's 2015.
From there to, now you jump up. What's changed? Population growth in the county or
number
new
one
laws
thing.
That make something a crime that wasn't a crime before or what?
I was going to say, I think it's a couple like things. That? I can maybe address that a little bit.
Sure.
Senate Bill 70 passed and went into effect last year, 2 years ago.
2014.
Okay, so
July 1st, 2014, but we did not. My contention is we didn't see the full effect of that on the jail side anyway until about May of last year.
And so year offenses that often had been sentenced to the penitentiary now for judges are presumptive probation and they stay in county. And I think Judge Spears and I are both following that pretty religiously, so we're not sending people to the pen.
A year or less.
Yeah. Well, and it's 180 days or less typically, but it can be up to a year or less.
Standard would be drug offense, non-drug dealer, around 90 days.
Minnesota now has it. If you're under 2 years, you stay in the county jail.
Just so people know what that chart on
very
the upper
similar.
Left.
Very similar to that.
Yeah. Just so people know what that chart on the upper left is, that where it just suddenly gets nice and even, that's the projection.
Right.
The black bars, that's historical data. So the rest is projection. So that's why it looks different at that point. That's right. You've all seen that before when you come into the meetings. That's right out of Bill Garnos' report.
And what I recall when Bill Garnos made his presentation, or at least the meeting I attended, he said that he didn't fully factor in Senate Bill 70 because it was so new and
yep.
and these numbers may be lowballed. But he didn't use those exact words,
no.
But I think that was his point.
And traditionally, when a law is enacted, from the time that it's enacted, it takes about a year for it to hit the jails. For example, in Minnesota in 1997, they changed the sex offender law, and they also changed the enhanced DWI. Everybody went, oh my God, we're going to have problems. Nothing happened. In 98, jail capacities went up 12 to 15% across the state because all of a sudden it started hitting the court system, and the courts had to react to what was there. So there is not an immediate thing. So Bill's right on by saying this may have nothing to do with your law that was enacted at that time because there is no data to look at.
And also to Bill's program too, if you all look at the way this kind of straight line is, there's three variations of kind of tone to this. The darker one, I think, Lee, which you were mentioning, is really a projection of actual inmates, your beds that you need. The above that, when we were talking about the operational capacities and things like that, that's what he calls classification factors. An ability to separate and segregate. He added the additional factors that they currently don't have, which they don't have the ability to do that. So that jump is really allowing for appropriate space for some of that separation and classification. Some of that was allowed for that.
You know, other things that can come into play, I understand that the Highway Patrol is fully staffed here now with four people versus one. Just because of that, or the city is fully staffed, or the county, I mean, you can't put it on one person. You can have a turnover of staff. The younger staff are probably can tend to be more aggressive. things happen like that. That's not quantifiable until you look back a year after it's happened and go, where did it come from? If we had the ability, or if the courts could go in and ferret out just the change in Rule 70, that would tell you how many more people get added to your facility or to the state than you divided out per county.
And I also want to talk about level of magnitude as well. So we are looking at 86 beds currently with an operational capacity of at least 10%. That puts it at 95. If we're talking about a facility that's 100 to 120 beds, it's not a big level of magnitude as far as big picture. It gives the proper growth area that the jail could need in the future. So you know what I'm saying? When people think about, oh my God, you know, no, it really should be 85 beds, and it should be, that amount is not so just so exorbitant to what we would expect to see with this type of facility. So again, I don't want to get so narrowed in and so focused on it, because it's not necessarily the big picture, it's part of the picture.
Correct. So, and the other thing, if 120 is a comfortable number to start with, then we go back and sit down with the sheriff and the jail administrator and say, all right, how did you have to separate them? Special management versus work release versus general population versus, you know, in the special management, what did we have? Did you have a pregnant woman? Did you have, you know, a racial tension? Did you have a gang issue? Did you have a juvenile issue with drug? Do we have to keep these apart? If we do, that tells us we have to have more smaller units versus larger units, so you can manage those people without getting 150 beds. You know what I'm saying? So if we start at a number, then we go after that number and see what we have left. Interestingly enough, I can tell you that my guess is by the time we're done with that 120, we'll be down around that 100 bed range, because of beds we'll lose defining the size of units. That, I mean, it works. Again, take two cells together over each other, that's 8 beds. You got 3 people in there, you've lost 5 beds. Of that 120, we're down to 115 already. I've got a racial tension issue, so I've got another 3-bed or 1-bed unit, 1/1. That's 4 beds. About one person in there, I lost 3 more beds. Unless they say, I've got to put somebody in with them, now we've just created an issue in the jail. So that bed number moves with the population that's in there. I know it sounds confusing, but that's the variable you deal with. And again, hopefully you understand the basis of what we're trying to come at and come with in order to find a definitive number to begin to look at the next step when Bruce starts talking about programming and areas and spaces. Have we beat that up enough yet?
It's a complex issue. Can be a very contentious issue what the right number is. And the last thing we want to do is, we don't want to over-design something, because it's ultimately cost and size, but we don't want to undersize it either, to where 5-10 years down the road, everybody's looking at each other going, we way undershot this, now what are we going to do? It's a tough situation. It's somewhat of a crystal ball. From what the data we've seen in Bill's report and some other information, it's very good and very thorough. So.
Yeah, it is. Yes, sir.
Really, my question was cause and effect. What caused? That's just a projection. Causing the projection to jump up 20 beds or
well,
whatever?
Well, Mr. Honda, if you can, I refer you to the website. It talks about all that.
No, I didn't look at the website.
Okay, let's.
I'm looking at this picture. I want to. I can't get my answer by looking at the website. I want. Answer to why?
Excuse me, Mr. Hahn. That it's population. We talked, discussed it, and so I'll refer you to the website.
One thing I want to ask: how much, if we're going to go on a while, we need to take a break.
We can take a 15.
The next topic we're going to go into is just discussion of the jail, of the court's caseload and the court's program. So we're actually going to another topic. So if you all want to take a 10-minute break?
I would say 10. We'll come back in 10.
This is the one that I knew that you were going to put you to sleep.
Yeah, one question on the jail.
Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, you're going by the ACA standards for space requirements. Did I hear you right? Minnesota requires less space than the ACA?
For the cells.
The difference is unencumbered versus encumbered. That's really the difference between the two.
Now, have they that requirement in statute. We don't have any over here. Mm-hmm. And has that space requirement or their space needs been challenged in court? And so, but has ACA been challenged in court?
No.
Well, I guess what I'm saying, what I was wondering, is if they have their standards, but you said they haven't been challenged in court, so we don't know if they're good or not. I was going to say, if they have their standards and if they're good, why can't we use their standards instead of the ACA? I'm just presenting that to you.
You could, from a cell standpoint, because that's really the only one that really varies, in my opinion.
Yeah,
much is the
that and
office.
Some of the other smaller rooms where they talk about unencumbered. You okay. could use that standard. Basically, if the county commissioners said, look, we understand we don't have a Department of Corrections that oversees what we do. We see what Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota does. Here's their standards for which they use. Really the difference is unencumbered versus encumbered. And it's got the programmatic things set in it, meaning we've got program space, we've got the standard day room space and everything else. You're not going to have an issue. One of the other ones, for example, is you have an outdoor recreation. In Minnesota, when I was the state jail inspector, we, you know, they required outdoor recreation, but when you look at the amount of time they can actually be out there, we put our emphasis on having a room, a multi-purpose room, for them to go to, and we put a jalousie window up high, so in the spring like this, we can pop the window open, we've got the fresh air coming in the fall, you've got the fresh air. In the winter, if it happens to be 60 degrees in January, they can do some exercise, they can jump up and down and get some fresh air. They can have access to that air year-round. We can turn off the air handler. They don't go outside. That's their room. And the federal government has acknowledged that because of the climate that we live in, that makes sense, that they can get their fresh air that way.
Well, I had another question to go along with that. What in your mind would be the savings cost on the 120 beds if you went from 70 square feet to 70 square feet unencumbered? Would it be negligible? Would it be a huge amount or what?
Yeah, it's going to be a...
So let's roughly look at that out of curiosity.
Okay.
So with the unencumbered, with the bunks and the beds are roughly 2.5 feet by 6 feet, the size of a bed roughly.
30 by 75,
so. For an architect.
For an architect, you can add, I like
that. 12, so it's almost, I would say it's about 14 square feet per cell. And if we were looking, and I'm just for kicks and giggles, if we're looking at roughly 120 beds, and we're looking at 60 cells, so 60 times that 14, plus or minus, so, and you add some grossing factors to it, because you don't have much, but it's about 750
to 800 square feet. 840 just for the 60 times 14.
So 840 square feet at a price of roughly about, I'm going to say, 350 a square foot. This works out to be what?
294,000 is the example. And that doesn't add in the grossing factor for the...
Well, you're already gonna have so you don't have a lot of grossing. But so that's the level of magnitude. Now, is it money? Without a doubt, it's a chunk of money. If you're looking at a $25 million, $20 million project, you know, it's not. It could be 10% of a $20 million project. So those are things that are important to discuss.
So that's kind of why that number is so important to talk about. Of that 60, of that number we just used, those 60 cells. Are 10 of those in the booking? Well, now we just lost 10 beds. because they're single cell. You can't double bunk in a booking area with people coming in. That's your most crucial area. Again, convolutes it a little bit, but that's the type of thing that you have to understand how you're looking at it. And it's a great question. Unencumbered versus encumbered does have an effect.
I was just wondering about how the courts would react to if there was a lawsuit, if we're following their standards as opposed to the ACA.
And I mean, it was a really good point because, I talked about how sometimes we go straight and we take a look. First thing that clicks in my mind is I'm curious about Nebraska, I'm curious about Iowa, I'm curious about some of these other states and their cell requirements. Because as far as I know, in Minnesota, it's not even challenged. They still, if you look at a 7x10 cell, it's still adequate space for them to have their privacy, to have their bunk, to have space that they need to function. And it's not, of course, it's not supposed to be the comfort of a large palatial home. It's supposed to provide the minimum level of appropriate care.
May I ask how long they had that standard?
Minnesota?
Since 1978 is when it started, and it's been promulgated 3 times. When I left in 2005, they had just, they were doing an update to the, it's called 2911 jail standards.
So in other words, in that 40 years or whatever it's been, they haven't even had one case project.
So if you're to say that the key is to put the key between ACA and Minnesota, it's unencumbered versus
encumbered square footages, and then looking at some of the what I would call ancillary offices, such as your holding areas, your different things like that. You know, ACA does a really good job of trying to be global with everybody, but if we sat down and we compared two different states, it took Nebraska and Iowa or North Dakota and Nebraska, because you're sandwiched in between. If we sat down with the commissioner, with the attorneys, and we looked at it and said, here's what they've got. Are you comfortable with that? Is that a defendable position to be in? And the judge says, yeah, I don't see anything. I mean, we're not skimping on the square footage for their rooms. We're not skimping on their day rooms. We're trying to offer them some programs. We've got good faith and effort going forward. I don't believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not on the legal side, I don't believe that you're going to have the issues that you would if you're not offering something. Right now, you're more vulnerable.
To some of the parts.
So.
That helps, sir.
Does that help?
Take a break.
Okay. Let's come back. Quarterly. Make it quick, so we're not here too late. I'll just go to court until.
So one of the next things we're going to address kind of briefly was what's happening within the court system as well. Currently, there is one what we could consider a medium courtroom size, and again, this is repeating of information that's been gone before, but it's just making sure we understand where it's going. There's one medium jury courtroom. There's one small non-jury kind of hearing courtroom. Court schedule over the last 6 months has been out. There's been speedy trials. Jeopardized. There's been a number of things that have happened within the court systems. Courts have been overbooked. I think Judge, we were just talking about that one of the courtrooms in that small court, that small judicial chamber we were talking about, was because of another judge being assigned and really no place to put that judge, and carving out a space for that area. Is that your chamber, Judge?
No. Thank goodness.
That's the magic. He has
the big one.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm the...
But you know, the interesting thing is when you look at these court filings in the chart here, you know, you look back in 1928, which of course was a number of years ago, and the world was quite different back then, not that I was around, but from what I understand. But you look at the 50s, you look at 1975, and clearly between 75 and 2013, there has been a change. And it's not just in Connington County. We've seen this kind of spike of caseload across the country. And it's unfortunately the dynamics of some of the things we're dealing with in today's world. A program was done, and that you had two programs on. And I'm sorry if you can't, it's probably so small, you probably can't see much of that. But what we did is we looked at the two programs. There was a program done, I think, in 2013 by an architectural firm.
Yeah, that's architecting. That's one on the left.
Yes. And I mentioned this early on, one of the first things we do is what we call a discovery process, where we're getting familiar with the information out there. And so we started to compare one versus the other. Well, the one that was done in 2013 on the left showed what we would consider typical court spaces, sizes of offices were nothing that was excessive. The sizes of chambers seemed to be appropriate, what we would expect. The total gross number, excuse me, was about 38,000 square feet. When the National Center of State Courts came in and they did their analysis, and they're a very, very good organization. They do courts programming, courts planning all around the country. We worked with them on one project as well, when we brought them on the national project. And they went through their analysis, and they came up with about 29,600. It's almost 30,000. The primary difference, which, again, I just wanted to point out, just so everybody understood, the primary difference between the Architectural Aid's program is they had five courtrooms. They had two large courtrooms, sure. Two jury courtrooms, and a large courtroom, and some other courtrooms, but they had five courtrooms. Whereas the National Center of State Court was proposing three courtrooms. And three courtrooms seemed appropriate. And again, if you look at counties of your size and similar around the state and in other states, three courtrooms is definitely not excessive. So then you multiply that with the additional chamber space, court administration, attorney conferences, victim witness, all these other spaces that support that judicial function. And really what we're saying is, as we proceed forward with planning, we're going to be using the National Center of State Courts, National Center of State Courts standard for what they come up with in an area. So the reality is, as you hired them from the initial consultant, there was a square footage that was rectified that's appropriate, and a program that was rectified that's appropriate. So we felt that that was appropriate as we go forward. One of the other things we're going to be working on in the next 2 weeks, like I mentioned earlier, is there isn't currently a jail or a law enforcement center program. And so what we're going to be doing is working with Tom and working with the sheriff. And again, it's kind of a little hard to see, but there's some standard spaces within a jail, of course. You know, you have visitation. Again, DCA and Minnesota have, based on the number of inmates, you have so many public visitation type spaces. You have, you know, food service, again, based on your inmate population, that kitchen needs to be a certain size for capacity and storage and things like that. And as we get into that, again, if we talk about 120 beds, but we want to plan for the future for 140, we're going to design that kitchen, we're going to design the support infrastructure to support that long-range. And those two long-range areas are primarily property storage for inmates' property and the kitchen area. Those are your two primary growth areas. We'll go through all this. Laundry services, typically, you know, more times than not, laundry service space is designed for the incidental breakdown of one washer versus another. We tend to specify commercial equipment. It costs more, but it lasts a lot longer, especially when you think of the amount of laundry that's being done in the correctional facility. But again, it's not a big area. It's just what's typical. But the other information that I've highlighted in yellow, that's where we start to get into how do we break down this inmate population. Based on the type of inmates you've been dealing with, based on where that the changes in the demographics might go, what's the most appropriate way to separate and classify and control the inmate population. So we'll be looking at that. And we'll also be doing the sheriff's office. You know, how many patrol deputies do they have? How many report rating stations do they need? You know, your general administration area. What kind of evidence storage, evidence processing do you do versus what you turn over to the state, and what kind of space do you need for that? Your tactical vehicles, your law enforcement emergency vehicles that are currently parked out of town a ways, you typically want to have those more readily handled, you know, available to you for when an incident comes out. But again, as we go through all this, we look for space efficiencies as well. Can a SWAT training room also be a training room for another function? Yes, but we look for those opportunities with people. So those will be doing the programming, and again, at the next meeting, you'll see those projections in that area, and you'll have that information ahead of time as well, which I mentioned.
Okay, the question with regards to the visitation. Does the state of South Dakota allow video visitation?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, as far as I'm aware, there's no restriction.
Hughes County does it as well.
And I would also like to add that that could be a cost savings because we could contract, I believe the technology's there to contract with somebody so that they could actually Skype from home, essentially, and yeah. save some square footage and have limited in-house visitation posts if we found the right vendor to do video visitation.
What I'm referencing for the rest of the group, in the standard it talks about one video booth per 10 inmates. A video booth has to have at least two that are ADA accessible, so you have to have basically 5x8 or 6x8 so you can have the 5-foot turnaround for a chair. With video visitation, because you can do more of it at a time, meaning an inmate can go to the inmate phone and schedule a visit with their loved one and have it recorded at 10 o'clock tomorrow. They pick up the phone. If the loved one came into the lobby and picked up the phone, they can visit for their 20 minutes. It's recorded on both sides. It's watched, and when they're done, if they hang up, we're not moving the inmate from the unit to a visit area where then they have to be monitored by another staff. They are visiting within the unit itself, which is very efficient versus having 10 people sitting in, for lack of better words, four little stanchions or six stanchions with people sitting on the other side of the glass, talking through the glass. They're now, the public, if they came to the front lobby, are sitting in a small room in front of a computer monitor. It's usually a 21-inch monitor with a camera in it, talking to the inmate in their unit. So we enhance the security, we've cut down on the movement. We're able to record it and monitor it because most of the systems now give the full disclosure right up front so that they know.
But, and that's a good point, Sheriff, too, is the technology has come around. There were some concerns early on as to that ability to monitor and control if somebody's at home or to monitor what they were doing. The technology has come to the point where somebody could be at home. Somebody's got disabled or issues getting around, mother or grandmother, whatever, can now do video visiting to the inmate. So that does work though. And I think in South Dakota as well, video arraignment is allowed too. And some of the other states have not allowed that. And again, video arraignment, when we did the Douglas County Court, it's with our jail facility, we actually set up a room within the jail that could be used for the video arraignment. When I worked on the Las Vegas facility, we set up all the judges' chambers so that it could be set up for video arraignment directly to the jail. It's an operational efficiency as far as moving inmates and things like that. So this was some of the initial criteria, I think a facility criteria, that you would all establish through various work sessions. And the first three that are listed up there, that are listed off on the right-hand side as a must, the priority. So those three were, it was a minimum size, and the minimum size required to, for all the spaces and features, to handle courts and jails for the next 20 years. So size of the facility is critically critical. Making sure we size it appropriately so it's going to last and we're going to have what we need for a period of time. Expandability. I think we talked about that a little bit earlier too. The ability to grow and expand the facility. You don't want to box yourselves in. And some of that, as we get into some of these sites, we might find some of that. You don't want to box yourself in such a situation that you can't expand. And we hope 20, 30 years down the road it's not an issue. Who knows what's going to happen in 56 years. So we want to make sure that the expandability is there. That's critical. Historic preservation, I think we talked about that. That courthouse, I've seen a lot of courthouses, and that's really a pretty courthouse. I know, like, it sounds like they've got a courthouse crush, but that's a very, very nice quality courthouse. So respecting that courthouse and making sure whatever's done, because like I said, you know, back when that was built in 1929, that was kind of the heart of this town. It was the core, I mean, bit, as you look at it. So again, making sure that preserved. Then there were some other issues that were discussed, but they were less important. They had a less level of magnitude. Operational cost. Okay, what's it going to cost to run this facility? Now, to me, operational cost is pretty important because the cost of a facility is, I forgot what the percentage always was. It was like 10% or 8% over the life of a facility. 30 years. It's very small.
And just to refresh on for this should look pretty familiar to most people, but the top three must do's, those are the ones that yes and no, you got to do it. If the option doesn't answer that, then the one, it's not the weighting, it's the priority on the 1, 2, 3 on the left side there. It's the so those
those next three with the one, those are the most important comparative, most likely we can use to compare. So.
So the operational cost, efficiency of design, and again, the expandability, those were the next three that were critical.
Yeah, those are the highest, yeah. Most important comparative.
Yeah. And I think operational, that's where the other term staffing comes in. You know, it's not just what does it run to heat it and light it and maintain it. This is where the rubber hits the road and we're talking staffing. If something is designed that's poorly designed and it adds five more staff, even at $50,000 a year with benefits, that's $250,000 a year over the life of the loan, it's $7.5 million without any inflation that you are paying. That's how sensitive it is when you're talking the design of a facility. It has to be staff efficient and safe at the same time. It's not being cheap, it's being, you know, good staff to inmate ratio.
So the efficiency of design, again, you have to have appropriate space, but it's appropriate without being necessarily excessive. But again, that's kind of a balance. Knowing this business, knowing how to properly lay out these buildings, knowing the modular design. One of the things we talked about too, and when you talk about the size of the cell, we actually did a study where we looked at cell construction. There's a facility here
here on South Dakota.
So Truss builds a manufacturer of a steel panel system. I use them in a jail facility up in central Minnesota.
They dump this.
Well, I'm sure
they were. Steel Cell, another manufacturer out of Georgia, that produces a prefabricated box that they basically drop
with
in place.
John Douglas.
Exactly. Anyway, we've done an analysis of jails using 2-inch panel, but basically like a quarter inch shim space between panels versus an 8-inch block wall versus a 10-to-8-inch block or precast panel. So some of your jail construction that you've seen typically is block construction, which is 7-to-5 basic. The metal panels, when you put them back to back, you're basically dealing with 4-and-a-quarter inch in the 2-cell configuration. Or precast, depending upon the type of precast, then the rotunda or some of these others, whether it's 8 or 10-inch precast wall. There's another one. Those were the primary ones we looked at.
Those were the three major.
So when we looked at it, what we did is we laid out cells. And we laid them out side by side. And what happens is that difference of 7-to-5-8 from cell to cell to cell versus 4-and-a-quarter from cell to cell to cell can actually save square footage in the wall. Can actually reduce the overall size of the box. Because again, what you're paying for is not this beautiful jail facility, paying for the square footage it takes to construct that and that facility. Heating and cooling, that has a factor over time. So those are some of the things we look at, I think, when we're talking about signs. And that's a topic because it will have some space implications, and we might dig into it a little bit, even though we're still in the planning and pre-design phase, but it does have a space impact. So I've got a lot of images and a lot of information that we've dealt with other correctional facilities that we'll probably show it to you, maybe even at the next one, so you can all see that and understand that a little bit. But again, some of the ones you've toured, you've seen that as well. So.
And I think the biggest challenge that'll come into play when we're talking square footage is the sites that you choose that you want to compare to. If we're stacking versus building vertical versus horizontal, open space versus confined space, that determines the efficiency for which the architect can design it.
Thank you. We're not just drawers.
When they take their crayons out and they go outside the line, you know we're in trouble.
This is when they used to work for DOC. We didn't know.
But it also affects the staffing. If we have a limited site and we push something, or the classic example that I always use is if we can have a booking area here and courts is on the second level and I can move an inmate from the booking area to the courts holding right behind the chambers and I can load them into two chambers at once, that takes one staff to do all of that. If I have to take the inmate from the cell to the holding and intake and then another staff has to walk them down to meet the bailiff on the other side, that took two staff. It's simple little things like that as we're talking. Those are the things that we'll talk about when we look at sites. Doesn't seem like a big thing, but if I can move them vertically this way versus having to walk them through a tunnel or anything else.
Right.
those are things that we'll go back and forth on.
And security will be a big issue as well. And that's something we look at as well. So project cost under the priority level two, project cost was up there. But again, part of the reason I think the bond referendum failed last time was there were a number of factors, but cost probably was one of the factors. So it's something we need to talk about. There's always a fine line balance between that, and we need to make sure that we're designing something that's appropriate, we're planning something that's appropriate, but we're doing it cost efficient as well.
I think the message between the operational costs and project costs is as this committee and the county commissioners approved this chart, is we're saying we recognize operational cost as a more important criterion than project cost. But so,
exactly.
So the
yes.
thing is, you know, we have to explain that to the public as we go through that. So, you know, we don't do this, you know, right. So that's kind of the takeaway from that.
Yes, sir.
And I think that's
another interesting way to say that is one of the things that we acknowledge is we're not willing to cut the overall project cost to come to some magical number if it's going to drive the operational cost higher either. I mean, when we talked about it, we want a true actual project cost of what we really do need without extra, but we're certainly not willing to cut it at this point in the design to say that's the factor. You only have $5 million, do it.
I truly hope that when we have the five different sites or however many you choose to want to evaluate and we can do what's called a bubble diagram on each one of them, that when you see that we can operate this with X, this with Y, and this with Z, and there's 9 staff here versus 5 staff here or 4, people have the choice to say, okay, I'm willing to do this more because it offers this. You know what I mean? They understand the big picture. That's a challenging one because it's not always the lowest price with the lowest staff. You know, it may mean, some example, it may mean we're 3 miles out on the end of the city limits versus being someplace here, whatever. What does the public want? They may say, we're willing to do this, but they definitely, that's the goal of us and hopefully the goal for all of you as junior jail consultants. You're all going to get a little mad. Right? Next week, everybody's going to be...
After we pass the test.
That's the critical one. Another one was midterm adaptability. I think talking to Lee, the understood standing that we came from with that is as technology changes, how do things adapt? You know, how can the facility adapt? And we're going to design in a lot of things that currently aren't there as far as security and requirements for some of those things, but how do you create some level of flexibility with it? It's a little tougher in jail. Just honestly, it is a little tougher in jail because of the hard construction. Once you're there, you're there. So the technology flexibility is a little tougher. But when you have operational, there's equipment, I think, officer down warning systems and things like this, you can build in repeaters and things into the building to help with some of that security information. Aesthetics, I think, was kind of a little lower on the list. Appropriate appearance. You know, and it's an interesting thing, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but when I look at aesthetics, part of aesthetics is identity. It's identity of the county. So it's not, you know, is a courthouse appropriate in a metal building or a pole building? Probably not. It doesn't represent the identity that you want your county to have. Whenever I would talk to courts, which is another one of my passions, is I would always liken it to your community church. The feeling you have and the representation of your community church and what that court represents within your community as far as the justice system and the stability and the types of individuals in the community. So when we talk about aesthetics, I don't always talk about it should look pretty, but it should identify, it should represent who you are as a community. So that's an important thing. So again, and where it's placed, does it appropriately represent the county? You know, if you're looking at building an entirely new facility, but it's out on some edge somewhere, is that representing the county? Is it a symbol? Is it providing the symbol of the county? So it's kind of a discussion point there. And then location, again, that was down there. How well does the option address the desired maintain the current court relationships and things like that, and that'll be an operational impact as well. I go back to Douglas County because I worked on that and I bit my tongue all the way because I knew that the long-term operational impacts were not going to be the best, but that's the way that it was pushed. And so you got to look at what those issues are. Is if you have staff going back and forth, if you have a certain organization, a certain number of individuals that are dealing with, you know, probation is down here, correctional, the individual correctional officer down here, but they're dealing with the jail, and the jail is 8 miles away, and they have to commute back and forth, and they have to run back and forth. Or if you have a certain courts element here, and another courts element there, what does that do operationally? So as we get into it, that location has an operational effect.
Can I just, what that criterion is expressing is the wishes, I think, of the whole town. Everybody on the committee would like to keep it in the downtown area. But it's priority three, because that's still not as important as, just as you said, Bruce, its operation. So.
So then I think we started to get into some sites. Oops, I'm going to change slides a second.
Can I say something before we get into sites real quick?
Yes.
Go ahead and pull up the thing, but just... this is just, there's some obvious sites, like, you know, where the courthouse is now, where the previous Justice Center was proposed. There's some obvious ones, but there's also going to be, you're going to see some brainstorming. We've had a few discussions with economic development and the city, so some of the ideas might look kind of crazy, but the idea is that we don't want to leave any stones unturned as we think about it. So it's a bit of brainstorming. So just, you know, so you might end up talking about the property that people own. So, but just to make sure that we're thinking outside the box. So and I just want to head up in your hand.
If your house is on there, you don't worry. You really don't worry.
Sorry about that.
If you want, I can pull it.
No, I got it right here. I just actually hit the wrong button. Oh, yeah, I need Aaron to say Bruce. So, Aaron. Is it this part?
You're hitting it.
For some reason,
Lee, one of the hardest questions that I always had to deal with when people asked is what's going to happen to the courthouse as now. Now, that's one of the real questions that a lot of people have. What's going to happen?
I think the way that at the moment, what I would suggest answering that with is we're. And one of these things that these guys are doing is master planning. And so that means, you know, what are we doing with all the, you know, what are we doing over time? What are we doing with different facilities? And we just need to make sure that the master plan addresses what happens with the courthouse, whether it's part of the solution, part of the justice facility solution or not. And that's, it's a learning process overall. It started a few years ago. So.
Once the committee accepts, say, three sites, and they determine who goes to those sites, and you backfill by saying, what's our reuse for the county, who's coming out and what's the reuse there? And that's where the discussion begins.
That was really a major hole in the plan last time.
Yep.
Okay. That's a learning thing. You know, just don't know what you're doing.
Actually, if you don't mind.
I want to just do it out of my
mind. Well, no. What I want to do is I want to actually, because that last one that you sent me, Lee, or that we talked about, did not have the blow-ups of those individual sites. It just had the overall.
Yeah.
And so I kind of wanted to go into this one just because we can view into the sites a little more. We'll go back to those. Okay, so this identified, on this one, 8, and we can go back to the other one. It was the... I think was the Greenfield site on the west side of 212 and over here.
So where the Justice Center was proposed when the vote happened. You might help if you just go right into this.
In the blow-ups?
Yeah.
So you can see there's the one here, the Rancota Convention Center site here. Some sites in the downtown kind of core area. And then there's one. Is this downtown? This was kind of that public
works. That's where the sale barn
was.
So, and just so people know, this is based on a quick conversation with the mayor. So kind of, again, brainstorming. So don't necessarily take it to the bank. The obvious ones are, you know, the courthouse and that one.
So this was a site that was previously proposed. Now what we're going to do with each site is we're going to look at a variety of things to help weed some of this stuff down and help make sense of it. Unless, you know, unless there's, again, I think we want some dialogue because some of your criteria does sit down a little bit of these, but we're going to look at what's the size of the site. We need to verify how big it is because as we start to put a footprint on it, how does that work? So we need to understand what the legal size of the property is. We'll work with the assessor or somebody through one of the organizations to look at what's the property cost. So we want to know for each one of these pieces of property, what's the cost. With some of these prices, some of these properties, there'll be some existing buildings. What's the age of the building? What's the structural stability of the building? Are we reusing the building, repurposing the building? Is it being demolished? Is it such an age that it might have asbestos? So on sites where there's existing buildings, we need to understand it well enough to understand what are the financial impacts of that potential site and opportunities. Utilities. How big are the utilities that branch out? The sanitary sewer, probably not so much sanitaries, but yeah, sanitary sewer and water are the two bigger ones. Is the water sized large enough to accommodate this? And we'll talk to our internal engineers once we have kind of a footprint on how big we think this facility is. Our mechanical plumbing engineer can tell us, oh, you're going to need a 6-inch line to service that sprinkler system and that water flow system. You're going to need a 12-inch sanitary sewer to service that, you know, ballpark. So if we know that the utilities are 2 miles away, we can talk to our civil engineers we deal with, and they'll tell us how much does it cost to extend those utilities. So we'll look at that as well. Public access is something we always look at. We have done, as a matter of fact, we just did a tribal justice center recently, and it was a big topic of discussion where it went because not everybody had cars. And so there was a concern for how people could get around. So depending upon where it is within the community, that can be an impact. Most people probably here have that transportation convenience, and so I think it's probably not as big a deal with public access. We talked about the visibility, the identity. Impact on local businesses is a discussion point. I think a lot of times the reason you do see courthouses and things in a certain location in kind of a core is because that courthouse has been there, the county attorney's offices that service and work in that courthouse are there, and it generates the need and the space that supports that and the people that operate out of those areas. But those people, that core group of people that are there day in and day out, are also supporting the businesses that are in that area, the restaurants and the other things that are in that area. So again, as you move out to some other areas, it has an impact. It can have an impact on your downtown viability, community viability. So this will be one site we looked at. It seems from what we see, and we drove past all the sites, it's a very sizable site. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, when you be taking into account the travel involved, right now we're down right in the middle of town, so everything that happens in town is right in the center of it. But now you're going to be having to transport like about 3 miles, drop off, go back 3 miles, and get to work. So would you be taking that into consideration?
Yes. That becomes part of the staffing. When you talk about that transport unit, that Monday through Friday, 7 in the morning until 6 at night, and how many people it takes to go back and forth. Yes, sir?
One other issue I've heard raised about getting away from a downtown location is most of the law firms in Watertown are centered pretty well right around the courthouse, and that anybody who's dealing with their attorney ends up getting considerable amount of time. If they got to travel 15 or 20 minutes to get to court, it raises their cost and stuff, and people have expressed a concern about that. I'm sure, depending where it'd be located at, in time, if there's facilities nearby, many of those firms may relocate, I don't know, but it's a question that's come up.
And it does create an inconvenience, and for those individuals, the clients of those additional attorneys, that does make sense. So those are all some of these things that we're going to look at. I think there's something else. And again, work release is another one that we probably talk about a little bit. We have dealt with some counties that have fairly large work release populations, the individuals that they deal with. And again, that fluctuates over time too, whether you have a lot of them or less. But if you've got somebody that's got a job somewhere in the city, they're working at McDonald's, they're working wherever, but now we put them 5 miles out of town, what's the impact? Is that person able to continue that job, or are they suddenly losing that job just because they can't get there? So So those are things we'll have to look at. And existing building utilization. If there's a building or a site that makes sense to try to use, you need to look at that. If you have an existing shell that's there, and we're talking about like a court structure or a jail structure in there, you know, if there's a shell that's there and it's in good quality condition, the roof's fairly new, the structure doesn't seem to have any defects to it, it's a solid building, there can be some savings trying to utilize an existing building, but that's something we'd have to look for. So this, we'll look at that with each site. We're going to develop, kind of go through this analysis, and one of the things we'll do with the next meeting, we'll go through each of these sites once we've had kind of, by the next meeting, I would like to have some preliminary footprints on whatever sites we think make sense. I would like to be able to see physically how they lay out on those sites so we can start going back and forth with some of these things and have more of this information.
So for the goal for the next meeting, are you going to, is the goal to have the five or less sites agreed upon, or do you want to be beyond that?
Well, there's two ways we're going to handle it, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but we could go through and adjust and identify how well each site satisfies the criteria, because this is the first time a lot of you all are seeing these proposed sites. So we could delve into it more once there's been some more conversation and some more thought on it, and that's probably the more appropriate time to do it, is to do that, do the analysis of how well each site satisfies it, come back to you with some of this other information about the utilities and some of the other things for the site. So maybe I'm getting a little ahead of
myself. Well, maybe, so you're saying like how much you would probably, like the requirements basically.
Yes,
how well the hard requirements.
Well, so we have to sift it down, and I don't know if everybody's ready to off the bat say, no, we're not going to. And maybe we will. And maybe as we go through the site tonight, people will say, no, that just doesn't make sense.
That's, I think I had a good conversation with the Watertown Development Corporation yesterday, and they suggested they could do it. You know, they could probably take a lot of sites, and there's quite a few, you know, just brainstorming, and they could look at them fairly quickly on some of the basic stuff like, utilities and very, very quickly, and then maybe the next meeting we kind of just tabulate that, and then say, okay, five or less sites, let's just agree on it. I'll try to.
It'd be nice to have Craig at the meeting too, just about some of those questions.
Yeah,
he's going to try to
be here. And so
hopefully we can just eliminate some of that.
Yeah, and that, and that's what, and so I think the Watertown Development Company and First District is our county. They can help us, I think, do that fairly quickly. We already pay dues to First District, so I don't think it's going to cost us anything. And then that gets it down to the level where you can do some hard looking. But yeah, if we have some hard data, the Watertown Development Company is used to dealing with sites, like manufacturing, so they're. I would think that some of the utilities requirements would be something similar.
And a lot of times soil conditions too, with geotechnical conditions, can have a big impact on the cost of the project. I'm going to be talking about the and we've had a couple projects recently where that's been a big issue. Sometimes, as a matter of fact, we might get down to three or four sites, and we might suggest doing a couple borings, which might cost $5,000 a site to verify the geotechnical conditions. I think I might have mentioned when we did the West Fargo Police Department, almost a $900,000 impact because of the cost of the project, because the poor soil condition was 10% of the overall project cost. So I'm going to talk to the first thing to do in a study like this is talk to the local building department. They're most familiar with the soil conditions and what's going on in the building climate, so we'll talk to them first. But those are other things we'll check on. So there's this site out on 212, which seems to be adequate enough size-wise, proximity-wise, it's on a major location, but again, each one will identify how things go. And the other thing we'll have to look at too, as we talk about some of this, is which is clearly going to have to be on the table, is which in my mind is a tough thing to wrap around, is if you build entirely new courts and jail out here, what happens to that building? What backfills, bless you, what backfills some of that existing court space? And that's going to have to be discussed. If there's other county or city agencies or state agencies that need space and can move into that courts area and lease it from the county, then there's a viable solution. It's not vacated, it's utilized. You know, or these courts operate there as some more civil service courts, and we actually have a separate secured courtroom and in custody court, kind of more secure courtroom as that facility. That's something we're going to discuss, I think, as we get into some of this as well. The next site we looked at, I think this was what we called
that's site. North Sail Barn, that burned down. But just for everybody's information, the city is kind of toying with the idea of making a street department. And so you have to ask the city about the details of that, but you know, they just said, well, they're checking it out, if you'd be interested, if it doesn't work out for them. That's what that site is. Just to give you the quick and dirty and what I know about it.
And from what you told me earlier, Lee, it sounds like that the owner of the property might end up trying to keep the frontage.
Some frontage there.
And so really the property you'd be potentially purchasing is towards the backside.
Yeah.
One good thing with this site is it appears there's a large water retention pond right there, so stormwater control will be pretty much right there. So
assuming there's stormwater in there if
it's a sewage just that's a different issue altogether. That's a good question.
I think that's a feedlot lagoon.
Oh, interesting.
But I'm not sure.
You don't want to know what's in there.
Well, in certain times of the summer with certain windows open.
Yeah.
I used to live down the road from the pig farm, so believe me, I know about breezes.
Did they say, Lee, how many acres that is?
I don't have it off the top of my head. But I do, I have it from the assessor. No.
Okay.
It's big, though.
Okay. It's probably 30 acres?
Three or four.
Oh, that's a big piece, bro.
I think that, from what I understood, if you counted a little bit of the lagoon and everything, it was between 15 and 17. So without that, I would guesstimate it probably around that 10 to 12 acre area.
And the good thing about Google Earth and some of our technology now, we can actually almost scale off of some of the stuff and get a rough estimation.
But I would say, you know, the thing to consider there is that the city has eyes on that one. Me, just thinking about it.
So here's the downtown sites, and from what we understand, as far as possibilities for the current site, it's kind of what we talked about a little bit before. Is, you know, one of the first options we always look at is, how do we best utilize this site? How do we make things work from a secure and fashion? And I think some of the previous architects had done some preliminary plans, and we're going to look at those again based on the current areas, based on the number of beds we're looking at, based on expandability, how well will this site respond? So that was one that, of course, we'll look at. Another one that was brought up was the idea of this auditorium across the street, the city auditorium. Yeah, from what we understand, it sounds like the city is building a new community center, and so the functions that occur in this current auditorium might be moved to that new community center. So if this becomes available, can this be part of some kind of complex? Like we talked about, if you're building steel cells and things like this, depending upon the structural conditions, this might be a very viable option. Or maybe, you know, we did look at the lot too, and to tell you the truth, this is a big lot.
Yeah.
This could accommodate a large facility on that parking lot area, large jail facility, if this was utilized for other property storage, kitchen, sheriff's office. It's got the double overhead garage door down here. I'm not sure what the space is down there like that, but it's something we'll look at.
And some of the issues of transport between, you know, either a secure courtroom there or a tunnel or something, you know, you have to do,
Yep. And parking will be something we look at each site too. I forgot to list that, but again, that's one of the drawbacks that always comes out down with downtown sites is where did everybody park? You know, if you suddenly build something right here, that's going to be one of the discussion points that we're going to have is, okay, we build here, and now where are we parking? And it's interesting, Pennington County, Minnesota, they've got this, their city zoning requires, I think it's one parking space per like six employees. It's really an odd, and then like five, and then like plus five. It's very odd. Most counties we've dealt with based on the square footage of the building. So the bigger the square footage, we don't count jails. Everybody agrees. There's not a lot of people. We don't have a lot of parking impact need for the jails other than the correctional officers and staff. But courts and everything else, they based on square footage of buildings. So anyway, that'll be something we have to look at. There was a discussion about potentially, I think the city was even in line with potentially closing Maple. The problem with this site, and we need to delve into it. The whole idea with this discussion, this broad discussion about sites, is what are the options, and what are the what are We would rather make sure we, with you, discuss all these options and logically eliminate things or logically accept things and make sure that all that data and all that discussion occurs so that it's clear to the public. Because what happens is we pick a couple sites and we say, oh, that's the great one. But we never go through this analysis of the multiple sites. Sure enough, we'll be sitting in a meeting somewhere. Somebody say, but did you look at this site? We think that's a great site. To tell you the truth, Pennington County evolved like that because we had a county attorney from another county sit down and say, well, you know, you're addressing human services and you're addressing the court need, but the jail doesn't seem to be part of this. We actually all pulled back and said, you know what, we weren't addressing it. So actually the direction we're going now on that one particular project came because somebody in the public challenged the way the direction was going. So we want to make sure we're looking at all issues.
I would just interject, if you're taking feedback at this point, that it's already been made very clear the opportunity to close down or have access to that Quest building is not happening.
That's what I understand.
So I would rather see D flip over and expand west out on the other side of the auditorium, maybe encapsulate that other side of the block.
So those are the kinds of things that say we just, you know, would say that, well, that's not going to be one of the five.
Right. Well, save us time at that point. I mean, we know that's not an option at this point. So.
But at the same time, that one's got to be put up there on a board that didn't make the top five and
exactly.
Why we didn't do it.
And why it didn't go there.
Right. You know, if that Quest building is the deal breaker, then there's, and the committee said, don't spend time on that. Then the committee signs off that says that we were directed not to go at this because of this building and the technology that's in the building. I mean, that's kind of where the wires are.
I mean, if it was on the corner up here and you had all this area to expand across here, not a problem. But right where it is, it basically minimizes any use of this building. Okay.
Well, then along on that same line, property E, that's owned by the city. The old city auditorium, or am I looking at the map wrong?
That's the old city auditorium. It's kind of the Art Deco building.
Is the city willing to sell that? I had some information or heard something that that was not an option, and they're going to keep that and build a future city hall there at some point.
That's coming.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Actually, the other thing to keep in mind about the auditorium is the Methodist Church is also thinking about it as it is an auxiliary building. So,
I thought the city wasn't willing to sell that at this point, but
I think if there was a good option, but I mean we're kind of brainstorming so.
That would be an excellent option if it was available.
Yeah,
that's what we think too, Jeff.
Does the city own that parking lot, or is that still county and
city
owned?
City
owned.
City owned.
Because that one time wasn't it half and half?
We only had a strip like
that. Well, the house garage was there in the late 80s and burned down, and then the city took it over.
Okay.
This is kind of brainstorming stuff, so let's
We're all in the 90s here, so let's talk about different looking outside the box. On that section B, I can't see it. Is that number 11 on that one building?
It's a fork in my mic.
Fork in my mic.
It's a Maple Street Diner.
That's the old Midland Natural Light. That is a steel frame building. And I forget how many square feet in it, but it's pretty large, and it's basement, three stories. People have suggested that the possibility of taking the auditor's office, register of these, all these non-court related entities in the courthouse and moving them over there, and then using the courthouse, remodeling it for all the court services, and then expand the jail going towards the east or whatever way you want. But there's parking around that house there, around that building, the fourth and the food building, or fourth and the lane. That parking around there is all available. So I'm just throwing that out as a possible option, because that building could be remodeled to anything you want, because that's, like I said, it's steel framed. And it's got the pillars every 20 feet, so
school.
One of the times we come down here next, if possible, we might walk through some, any building that we're going to put on the table as a viable option. I want to walk through for ADA accessibility and potential impact. So we might look and say, okay, you know what, we can get the courts in here. We'll add a new court security entrance here that's a secured access to the building. The new front door will really just actually be more of a, it'll be closed off for security. You can only come into a single point. And we can do some things to increase security and move people out and address this. The problem is, if you suddenly say you're moving over here, it's gonna have a cost impact as well. Mm-hmm. And so depending upon the age of the roof, the condition of the building, the accessibility issues, if county and the purchase price, again, the county, and it's, we got to look at it. We got to put everything on the table. We just want to make sure we're doing our due diligence to look at it with enough detail that when you suddenly go in a direction, you've got monies allocated for what those costs.
I've known measurements before, but you have to see that there's not just adequate room, but adequate room for expansion of your auditor's office and all these non-court-related services.
Next one we had. So this one was.
That's where the that's across from the fire station. Just in
the, oh yeah, the fire station was up here.
Yeah. So that's just a brainstorming idea. There's a warehouse about where the letter F is. So.
The same Barclay.
I don't know the name of it.
Oh, the Barclay one would be to the right.
Yeah.
The F is the four-story storage building.
Yeah. It was former manufacturing. So the challenge with this site would be the gas station. But we just keep going. And there's going to be a number of, each site's going to have its own.
Yeah, and I mean, this, again, we identified the entire block as a possibility. You know, once we start to talk about what might go there and understand the footprint, it might only be this area. So it's really understanding that as well. At least identifying the sites. Thanks, sir.
Okay, should probably, yeah, this one doesn't have an opening. This is the guest house.
Yeah, so we didn't identify a property because we didn't, at the point when we looked at it, we didn't understand property limits, but I think, you know, so the fire station's right here, and I think potential property limits could be all the way around here.
So this one is this city, this would be trickier one in some ways because the city's thinking about a new city administration building someday somewhere on here, but there is a lot of space here. So the city mentioned that to me, that there's a lot of space here. And again, this might be a thing, kind of like what Mr. Poisson was suggesting, that, you know, if you could fit all the court stuff in the courthouse or around, you know, with upgrades and whatnot, you know, would you ever want going with the city and brainstorming and have a common administrative building? Like the Brookings type of setup.
I mean, I know there's a lot of politics sometimes that come into play creating a city-county building.
They had to work out their agreements ahead of time. I mean, all the memorandum, yeah, that's the challenge. You've got to work out all that operation memorandums and understanding.
But there can be some space efficiency created there.
Yeah.
When you look at public bathrooms to support the things that you do, two buildings versus one. And you look at community rooms and large meeting rooms that can be dual purpose for city and county. You look at a county city council and a county board meeting, depending upon schedule. I mean, there's some dual functions that happen that, if they're planned appropriately and if it's a good relationship with city and county, that possibly is an option that could have some validity. So,
that'd be a challenge.
In your experience, have you done many city, county, per se, dual-purpose buildings, structures?
On my head, it seems more times than not, they've been separate. Douglas County was going down the path with their law enforcement center of being shared, and it went for a number of years until it just went south for a number of reasons. It was more political than anything else.
Either the sheriffs don't play well together, or the commissioners and the city council don't play well together.
or the county administrator and the city administrator don't get along. I mean, there's always a level at some point somewhere where there's a hitch, or else somebody's feeling like, well, you're getting more than me and less than me. And you got to have a lot of continuity and a lot of balance and a ton of understanding to put the two together. Then there are others that work really well together.
And if I may just interject, the reason I say that is one of the things that people have noticed right here, and it's talked a lot about 45 miles south, Brookings County, that's exactly what they did. They built an administrative building together, half of it basically city, half of it's county. They moved their county offices out of the courthouse and remodeled. It was a beautiful thing. It is a great thing. We actually toured it. It's wonderful. However, in, what is it, 6 years or 7 years, in talking to the commissioners now, lots of them are telling us it was the biggest nightmare and they should have never done it, and they're actually being re-elected out of their positions because of the problems of just cost-sharing and working together. And that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you mentioned that. I was trying to think of all the facilities we've done. I can't think of a lot where they're shared facilities at all. I mean, I'm going through all the facilities in my mind, county and city, and I just can't. Even when we did the Eau Claire study in Wisconsin some years ago, it was initially city-county, and when, at the end of the day, when they ended up building, it became separate city-county operations. And again, from a law enforcement standpoint, if you're sharing, and actually we have a number of facilities, to tell you the truth, that shared PD sheriff's office. They seem to play pretty well. They're dealing with the same people out in the streets. You still have different spaces, different staff spaces, different evidence storage spaces. Southern Minnesota, Olmsted County, they share us county city PD, but based on where Watertown is with their PD, that's really not an option for the table. But so again, I think probably for the complexities you kind of bring up, I just think it's probably a viable option. Even though it's constant.
Well, it's been something that the city mentions, and there's a lot of space on that block, so, you know, that's going to be maybe a trickier one to say, think about it or not. And maybe we don't think about it as a courthouse. Maybe it's later on down the road, you know, we deal with the questions that Tyler was mentioning, you know, and it's just something that the county and the city do separately from this.
And part of the question is, where are they in line with doing it? I mean, that was one of the issues with Alexandria.
Where do you mean, the process?
In the process.
Yeah, I don't think they're that far.
Okay.
So
very, very early in the process.
Okay. So,
like, I'm sure when it hits the paper, there's going to be city council people that are going to go, like, that early in the process. Yeah.
So they haven't even thought about it yet.
Yeah.
That early in the process.
Yeah.
So, again, timing of when all these need to occur can be difficult, too, to make it.
And they are all potential. All they are is some discussion.
Yeah. And then this was next to the Ramcota, the conference center. I think there was some discussion that really there could be a large amount of property available. In addition to the conference center, there could be a large section of property over here that's available as well, off 212, again, very similar to the property down the road. I got to believe with everything that's along 212 under utilities are probably not such an issue. This is kind of an interesting deal here. I think one of the things that we talked about is the idea of if the city were to build a new convention center closer to 29, that really was the city's goal, and this became available, could this be utilized? It's a very large space. I mean, I'm sure most of you have been in that convention center that's over there. And, you know, when we walked into the day, you go into this really large meeting room, and you just, you know, you can very visualize the pods. And the fact that they've got the height that they do, you can stack up a couple tier cells in some of those areas. The benefit you gain out of that is if this core area works, you're building, potentially doing a steel cell or something, sliding something like that into that structure. But you got to realize what you're buying is the shell. Everything on the inside gets torn out. Other than if you can utilize the bathrooms. I mean, things like that you try to, that are costly construction items you try to use, but there's a lot of that in a new jail construction would go away. You know, again, the auditorium was a beautiful auditorium area. how to use that in a courts facility and a jail facility. It's not kind of typical. So there's some costs there, throwaway cost in construction, but it's something to potentially look at. The other sites, I don't think we had in the blow-up slides. If you want to, I don't know if you can zoom in any of those, or if you want to talk about those. Do you want me to pull up that other slide?
Yeah, we could just pull that other one.
And we could walk around a little bit. Of course.
There's more brainstorming. This is so that brainstorming was kind of a little bit with the city, and again, it's brainstorming. So these are just ideas that are being thrown out. And that's I think people know that.
So a couple.
Sorry.
So I finally got a chance to talk to the Watertown Development Corporation yesterday. Sorry to link up. Just a couple other odds and ends that we might, and again, brainstorming. So this is the Ramco where the event center that Bruce was just talking about. A couple other places out west. This is out of town. This is a site that the Watertown Development Corporation has right now. It's probably. Across from the trailer park there. It's a potato storage place. So that's pretty remote. That'd be unusual if it's in the other town. This is a site just north of where the previous Justice Center site was, but it's on 4th year. You still have to watch the runway. That's, we haven't asked the city about that, so we don't know, but that's another possibility. It's a steel barn. No, just working down from here. This is up by the bus barn. Just somewhere along here might be a possibility to think of something in the northeast. I think eventually this is going to be zoned, you know, maybe like commercial. I'm thinking someday we can be more things to that. Looking east on just this side of the interstate, you have the area on the SDOT. So it's from the, so I think Greg Glenn knows that. I think you actually have numbers of that spot there.
You got it again?
Thank you.
Okay. Well, there's
a decision. Yeah. Well, thank you, Sam.
Let's see. The only other downtown site that I can think of right now is north of the police station. There's a lot of there's parts of Larry's Lumber in that whole area that stretches all the way to the Hubbard elevator. The problem with that site is you have that peaking station right there, that port peaking station right next to it. But it's kind of a long site, but that's something to think about. I think that was, yeah.
Is that the one that goes behind Great Western Bank on the dog?
One? No, it goes the other, it goes from Maple over to 81.
Somewhere I saw one where it goes on the north side of Great Western Bank.
That was actually in an interview with the other architect, but I mean that's another possibility where it goes towards the title company, the old railroad station. I mean that would be, that's another possibility too. So where that jacket would be that story. So
probably the guest house is that a possibility because it's old building.
So
that, or I'll throw another one out right across the street from south side of Great Western Bank, the Lombard Street,
the bar parking lot,
west of Wells Fargo. You just tear all those old bar buildings out of their home, down the block.
I keep my parking lot open. A lot of beer bottles.
Lee, I don't want to regress, but to go back to where we're at right now, the courthouse.
Yeah.
My concern was parking. Well, park across the street to the west. Use the parking lot to the north and build on the east, west, on the west side, then go across the street to the west for that. That's a big parking lot right there. It's already a parking lot. You know, and in South Dakota, we never think of multi-level parking, but, that could be a possibility too. But the thing would be nice is if one of you would house those prisoners for a couple of years where we could tear down that and build the whole thing on the south side of the courthouse and make that functional, that'd be perfect.
It would be good.
Yeah.
That is one of the biggest challenges, to use the site in reuse.
It's, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
What do you do with those 86 people for up to 14 months?
But there is a parking lot across the street to the west.
Well, I was talking about the people that were incarcerated.
Yeah, I know.
So the parking part, we ought to use exercise.
Yeah.
If that turns into City Hall, then we just lose all of our parking. We don't own any of them. That's true.
That's
one of the impacts we look at. We have to house out of county, because that is something we discussed. If one of the options is to demolish that and construct a new facility, aside from transport and all kinds of other operational issues and impacts, you know, if you had 80 inmates at $50 a day, that's $4,000 a day over a year. Is that $1.5 million in transport? So, you know, potentially it's a sizable amount of money to house out of county. And then the other issue, that, as a matter of fact, we just came up with another project, there's no place to house them. Where are you putting them?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've got a lot of people out of work.
Yeah.
And they're not going to come back after a year.
Some of your staff, exactly. Yeah. So normally, whenever we look at things, again, we look at it phased way. We've actually, matter of fact, met with DOC 2 weeks ago about another facility we're doing, where they allowed us to really construct some drywall temporary in a building, some temporary kind of drywall construction with some security levels to it, realizing it was a very interim temporary holding type space. So that seemed to work well too. They're much more lenient.
We had two other suggestions that I had made to me. One was the property that the Drake is currently on, down on the corner. And then also on East 212, back behind the Redland Center, is the Verifications Building. Quite a bit of open land back there. So that might be two other just to.
Yeah, that's, that would get it on east and something to think about.
Yeah.
I just noticed one thing, I wanted to start thinking about just brainstorming stuff about east, because everything was very west and downtown. So.
Did you look at the highway shop, county highway shop site at all?
That was one.
County highway shop was one of the first.
That was one we talked about the last time. I mean, we can think about it again. We have to relocate. I mean, that's something.
We also looked at that other site just above where we had the bond issue that was looked at the last time too.
Yes,
because there would have been quite a bit of work that had to be on grading on that road had it been like that.
It's
the one off 4th Avenue.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where I have the high road.
Yeah.
This one.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think if you guys are, I think what maybe the next step, you guys have done this before, but what I'm thinking is maybe we take more comments like this. I think people from the public might even contact us with some ideas. And we're within the next week or so, I'll get with Craig from Watertown Development and maybe Todd from First District. And they offered, Craig suggested that it would be a fairly easy thing for them to do it quick. Run down utilities and stuff. In the meantime, you can get the parameters, kind of, I guess, the footprint. And the
So if you give us, what I'd like to get is pull together like a comprehensive list of everything that we've heard tonight to make sure we put everything on the table, and then we can go through and we can start sifting through that information.
We talked before about, do you need to give us like some minimum things or just, let me talk to Watertown Development and see what kind of things they give to us. But it sounded like it might be a useful thing to you.
Property size, value for the property, utilities. Those are probably the biggest things that we're going to look at initially.
And soil conditions.
Yeah, soils we're going to assume, unless there's been something that's come up. And again, I'll talk to the building department about that in a general sense.
If they know about it, they already know something about soil. They do talk about the soil and the previous go-around.
We didn't get that.
We didn't get in depth in the whole soil discussion, but there was some discussion of that, of the soil. I mean, it's pretty much known that throughout the area we do have a very decent sandy clay base. West side has a little bit more black dirt top side than the east side. There's a little bit more sand on the east side. But essentially in this area, it would have to be a very specific spot that you'd run into a big issue.
And we got a pretty good idea of something with this. We got the broad brush stuff, we got a pretty good idea about something.
the biggest issue you're running into is groundwater on some of those sites. There's places you can put a sand point in the ground right here in Watertown and pump all the water you want. So, I mean, that can become an issue if you're going to build construction of any size.
Okay, how about the ASAP auctions then?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was talking about. Yeah, with yours and that, yeah.
At least at the auction, I mean, that's built up already.
Yeah, that's basically kind of encompassing.
Yeah, okay. But,
yeah. Any of those out there from a fire standpoint that have a chemical issue that's registered? I mean, you have the stockyard burned down. Is there any residual other than that holding pond? I mean, somebody's going to have to own that at some point and take care of that.
Yeah, there really wouldn't be. The stockyards, I'm not exactly sure it was built in the 20s or 30s, but it's been there an awful long time, so.
What was the manufacturer?
I know what you said. Manure.
You're gonna have maybe nitrogen issues in the soil, which really aren't a chemical process.
I mean, like the one block over here that they talked about with the gas station on it and the body shop on it. Well, they're. Until several years ago, they were unregulated with regards to using.
Well, okay, that is a true fact. When you mention the guest house property, depending on how far you go, because the next property to the west of that is the Mel Dolly tire store. There's a good portion of that that used to be a gas station, and there is a very strong belief by the city that you will find contaminated soil when you dig in that area. There's no proof, but I can tell you that from the fire department doing our rebuild 3 years ago, that was one of the things that was looking to go to the east, and they just said, there's a strong possibility of contaminated soil here. We're better to stay away.
There was also a large amount of old batteries stacked or piled and stored there for a long period of time. So I would say it probably could be an issue.
I mean, doesn't rule it out, but at the same time, you know, there's a Superfund issue there that you got to pull that soil out and haul that out.
The other question to him, and not to get too sidetracked, but sometimes states do provide funding for soil remediation and things like that. I don't know if you dig into that.
I don't know if South Dakota, Minnesota has a Superfund, is what they call it, for old gas stations or something that have gas tanks buried in.
Let's proceed this way. So if you go back to the agenda was. I think for this part of it, we'll probably hear something from the constituents about some other ideas. I'll get over to line this up with the Watertown Development and First District as I can to see what they can help us just to screen out and eliminate some the we're brainstorming, so there's going to be some silly ideas here, so we'll get rid of those, and then maybe next meeting. Hopefully, we can agree on the sites that you guys get serious about.
And then boil down a little bit.
In the meantime, you can come back and give us any other parameters you really need us to think about between now and then by email, or phone or whatever. And then you're also going to talk to the sheriff about, by teleconference or something, or conference call or something.
Yep.
About.
We'll be talking about classification,
yeah.
As well as we'll be talking about programming.
Okay, and then the other thing on the agenda that we had was if we had to modify the criteria. Now I don't think we need to do that, but at some point, if we ever need to modify that, or at least say, I think all the things you mentioned kind of fit. You know, it's just a different way to parse out a word or order the criteria we already agreed upon. But if we ever need to, we just want to keep the county commissioners abreast of what that looks like when it gets translated into. You guys do things the way you do. So those are kind of the three biggies I see. I don't see the last one is something that's an immediate thing. It's just something we need to be aware of.
Typically what we do, the way we analyze multiple sites like this is we put together a site matrix. And we'll list all the sites, and we'll list all the information, and we'll do very much like what you did before and say, okay, out of 1 to 5, how is it important that this criteria satisfy that? Is it a 5? It's very important. Is it a 1? Not so much. But we expand upon the list you have to make. We might have 10 factors.
Yeah.
And then what we'll do is we'll go back and we'll rank how well we think each one of those sites satisfy those factors, and then we'll come back to the group and review that with you all and say, how well do you think it? What that ends up being is it ends up being a numerical number at the bottom that shows the highest number site satisfied the criteria the best. So it's a numerical analysis ranking for the sites. I like that. It's a little ambiguous. It takes a little discussion sometimes because one person is feeling about how well it addresses the civic image or whatever of another one might be different. But at the end of the day, it's a pretty logical analysis. It's somewhat defendable.
Yeah, that's kind of how we did your guys' proposals within our architectural proposal. We had a something like that.
And we were at the bottom and said, I don't give these guys a shot.
I think that might be the most of the agenda. We can hang around and discuss more, but I think we probably might need to adjourn so that anybody that needs to, we're close to 3 hours now. So so if you don't mind me, I'm gonna
I think this is fine. We'll come back. Just so everybody knows, there's some tweaking that I wanted to do to this information that we presented tonight, primarily referencing the report that it came from, the date, but then this will be part of the minutes.
Yeah, we'll add it. We'll add it to the minutes.
Yeah.
So any unfinished business, new business, anything for the open?
I suggest we move the meetings up a half an hour at least. If we're going to continue to have, go like a 5:30.
5:30. We order pizza.
I'm good with that.
Okay.
I really am, because I think 9 o'clock is really
good. That's all for you. Okay. Yeah. All right.
Very native here.
Just the opposite. I'm still a night owl.
Okay.
I think tonight is one of your longer nights. If we can, we'll set a goal that says we're on the way to 30 or 15. Why don't we do that? I mean,
you guys warned us that this was going to be a long one.
This one was the toughest one for the classification and talking about it. And I appreciate you all taking the time and staying with it.
Okay.
You know, from here on out, it's taking the sites and ferreting things out. And
okay.
We'll have a program with the sheriff and his people. So.
And to be respectful of your time, too.
Yeah.
It looks like we have a lot of that are concentrated. We'll have another meeting. We'll spread it out there.
Yeah, we can always add. Any new? So the next meeting is May 24th. I had on the agenda that we could talk about future dates, but I think we got it all mapped out for now. If you're going to have trouble with those dates or something, you know, we need to look at a tweak, then we'll work it. Anything else for the unfinished new open? Okay, then I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So
moved by Commissioner Applegate. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you all for coming. Great night.